biggest song of the week, Hail to the King, Avenged Sevenfold. That's it for me and Carrie. It's time to hit the tables. Let's get out of here.
That's right, a little poker. Follow us on Twitter at Nikki6. I'm at Carrie Kasem.
See ya.
Sideshow, Nikki6.
WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Well, unfortunately, it's just me, just Peter, with you tonight. Jolene was broadcasting live from the boat show this afternoon. You know, she does a long shift on Sundays, noon to 5 on our sister station. And she came over to our house, my wife and I's house, and seemed not doing real well then and was complaining about a horrible headache. And turned out someone else with our promotion staff had the same symptoms. So I have no idea. I mean, it's not life-threatening or anything like that. But when Jalene doesn't show up, believe it, she is way under the weather. So we're going to miss her. But please join us at 313-298-WRIF. Wait, what's this we, Werby? What, do you have a mouse in your pocket? Or the royal we, even worse? No, it's Jefferson and I. Jefferson will be taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF. And after all these years, I still cannot remember what the numbers are. But you know, work with it. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And Jefferson will get you on the air. You can either suggest subjects of your own, or I will suggest plenty. Believe me. Let's see. Our Facebook page is going. I don't know whether it's how updated it's been. Jalene usually does it around now. Actually, I don't think she's put our guests on tonight, but you can go to my website and see those. Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And if you'd like to email us, you can do that real easily. It's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I think in all the years I've been doing this show, I never have started with an email. Maybe if there was really a provocative one, but I can't really remember it. But last week I was talking about how our show is goes around the globe via our podcast and our stream. And I said we have listeners in Finland and Shanghai and Seoul and Mexico City, you know, all around the United States as well. Where else? I can't even remember them all. And Scott writes in from Sweden. He says, next time you're reading off your list of far-off listeners, he says, don't forget we Scandinavian. Can I say it right? Scandinavians. I've been listening for you for years and never miss a show. Well, thank you, Scott. And you've sent in some good remarks as well. Here's another one, just because I feel badly. This is something I missed. Mark, all the way out in Ortonville, that's almost to Lansing. He writes in, dear Pete and Jalene, I was among the 6,000 bicyclists that attended the Tour Detroit, right, on Saturday. Yesterday, it was absolutely fun. The police and fire departments were wonderful, blocking the intersections and rooting us on. The kind of people Detroit came out to watch, and the warm greetings were appreciated. The only downside of the day is that I should have invested in a better bike seat. Cheers to the city of Detroit for having us. I'm looking forward to doing it again next year. P.S., do they make inflatable bike seats? Yeah, they do, but that's not what you want. I should have ridden in it. I'm going to do it next year. If you go to that, if you just Google Tour Detroit, they have other events, including one that's going to cycle over the Ambassador Bridge, which, you know, I think it's like October 17th or 19th or something like that. But I'm going to do that as well. And I should have been on this one. Okay, we are off. And guess what I'm looking at on my screen? No, not porn. No, that was a bad guess. But here, it's from healthcare.gov. Healthcare.gov. And it says, the health insurance marketplace is coming soon. A new way to get affordable coverage launches October 1st. And answer a few questions to learn if you qualify for lower costs. And then it says, see all your options. This is Obamacare beginning to work. It's already been there and working. And, of course, the Republicans are going nuts. The idea that we would have anything approaching a health system like every other industrialized country in the world just sends them absolutely over the edge. Forgetting about that it really, this system is all private insurance, and they voted down the government programs, and will, in many ways, it will benefit the majority of American people. It also will benefit the insurance companies. They'll get more people buying their insurance. But this came about from the Heritage Society, which is this far right wing think tank, although I think that's kind of an oxymoron. That's who initially came up with it as a way to fend off government-financed health insurance. They didn't want that, so they put this in. What's Obamacare? Obamacare is Romneycare. Remember that guy? Remember? I got to remember the first name. Jalene usually tells me. It's not George. It is Mitt. Yeah, how soon we forget and how well we should. But Mitt Romney presided over Romneycare in Massachusetts when he was the governor there. Highly successful, the absolutely same thing as so-called Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act. And that's what's very important. So the millions and millions of people that are now denied health insurance are going to be able to get it. Is it going to be crazy? Is it going to be confused? I started looking at this website, healthcare.gov, and I went, whoa. Am I glad? You know, it's from the government. Am I glad that I'm not going to have to go through this? But they say answer a few questions to learn if you qualify for lower costs, because a lot of this is going to be subsidized, particularly for the people that can't afford it, that don't have private insurance and don't have it because they either their employer, usually that's the case, their employer doesn't offer it. And you know what? Employers shouldn't have to offer it. It's such an extraordinary cost. Why doesn't the government take it over completely, just like they do in Canada, just like they do in England, just like they do in France, just like they do in Italy? I won't name all the countries, or we'll take up the next 15 minutes or what have you. If you've had any experience with this so far, give us a call. Boy, I keep using the plural, don't I? Give me a call. Jalene's off tonight. 313-298-WRIF. Now, the Republicans have gone absolutely berserk. Absolutely crazed. They claim, I just heard some right-wing nut coming in here. He said, this Obamacare will be the death of our country. Obamacare will be the death of our country. Now, I mean, talk about hyperbole, right? Now, it could be bad. What are they, what's the phrase? Actually, I probably have it here. The phrase that Boehner has used, you know, the Speaker of the House, Boehner, right? Do we have to go through that again? Why his? Oh yeah, that's the whole thing. The law is a train wreck. They don't really say why it is, but they keep saying that. So this is one of their little catchphrases that will that gets into the public lexicon. So now people will say, "What do you think of Obamacare?" Well, the law is a train wreck. Yeah. Well, what do you mean? I don't even know. If you said, hey, Pete, I don't understand this. Tell me about Obamacare. The only thing I know, it's going to make it affordable to millions of people more that previously had to exist without it. So this is good. And, in fact, the number of Americans lacking health care coverage has fallen. If you're ringing, by the way, Jefferson is taking some calls. Just be patient. He will get to you. Yeah. And one of the reasons is because where is this? Oh, yeah. One of the most popular provisions of the 2010 health care law allows young adults to stay on their parents' insurance policies till age 26. What a concept, huh? That provision appears to be having its intended effect. The other people that have done real well with it are people with pre-existing health care issues. And before, insurance companies would say, I'm not insuring you. Just like if you have like a terrible driving record, they'll say, then they'll charge you. I think you're going, I don't even know what the deal is. It used to be going to a pool, if that's still it, or they must have to get some auto insurance, right? But the sweeping federal health care law making its major public debut next month was meant for people like Juanita Stonebreaker, who's 63 years old, who retired from her job in a hospital billing office a year and a half ago. Now, this woman worked in a hospital and now has no health insurance. She was able to continue her health insurance coverage from the hospital for a time, but when she tried to find an individual policy of her own, none of the insurers she contacted would cover her because she was diabetic. And what do the insurance companies want to do least of all? They want to return as little money as we've all put in as they can. Because the more they keep, the more they can distribute to their stockholders, pay their CEOs millions of dollars, and to do everything they can to deny us coverage or payouts. But here's the deal. She's a little over a year away from qualifying for Medicare, the federal insurance program for people 65 and older. She now worries a recent hospitalization will leave her several thousand dollars in debt. And that's what people face. I mean, this is why so many people have gone bankrupt because of health care. But under the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, insurers must now offer coverage to people like Ms. Stonebreaker, and they will not be able to set premiums they charge on the basis of someone's health. So we all have to get in this, right? Everybody has to be insured, because those that don't use it, in other words, we have insurance. I paid thousands of dollars over a decade in car insurance, and I never get any payouts, right? Because I don't have major accidents. I don't have made. I don't, you know, get injured. I don't cause great property damage. So they, the insurance companies, have kept all this, and what they do, they use that for the payouts of the people that do have catastrophic accidents or even small ones, right? So that's the way these mass insurance policies make it affordable for everybody, right? The Affordable Health Care Act. How in the world these nutball Republicans think this is going to be the death of the Republic is so far beyond me, I don't know. I mean, are they opposed to Medicare? Well, some of them are. You got to remember that. Some of them would like to go back to the 1920s when you got old and poor. T.S., right? That's just tough stuff. And a lot of them didn't – no, that was Social – wait a minute, let me see. Let me get back here. That was 65, right. But they also didn't want Social Security. That was the other thing that the Republicans fought really hard against. So they've always been against all of this stuff. And one of the things now that they're urging people to literally break the law – you know, this is what used to be the party of law and order. Now they're the party of lawlessness and disorder. They want to make sure that people do not take advantage of this and make it unworkable. Here's something that was passed by the Congress of the United States, signed by the President of the United States, and they want to make sure it's unworkable. These people, and why are they in such a rush? Why are they frothing to the extent that they are? They say over and over again, if it gets in and it works, people will get used to it. They'll like it. They'll see that it actually provides them with a great deal. Now, are there going to be glitches and people going to get screwed up by it? Yep. Are people going to get screwed by it? I'll bet. I'm not saying for sure, but, you know, this is a new program, and the Republicans have done everything possible to make it not work well, even in the bill and all the compromises that the president and the Democrats have to make. So, I mean, the easiest way would be a single-payer government health plan like every other country has. Then all of this rigmarole and all these options that are on this page at healthcare.gov, they wouldn't even be a problem. They wouldn't even figure into it. Now, the party of wreck and ruin, the Republicans, and have finally throttled and got Speaker John Boehner to wave the white flag. And what he did, he surrendered to the Tea Party, and now they've passed a bill which ties money to keep the government open after September 30th, which is coming up in just about a week, to stripping President Obama's health care law of any financing, any funding. And the House originates, that's the Constitution, originates spending bills. So what they've said, they've passed a bill that said, well, what isn't this like the, literally, you folks know this, the 43rd time that they voted to defund Obamacare. Now, you would think they might be involved in some other issues that would be helpful to the American people, but this is what they're all about. Now, the government is going to shut down. Unless there is this resolution that a bill that allows funding so that the United States can meet its debts and payments. Here's what Representative Tom Graves, the Georgia Republican whose defund Obamacare push has got 80 House supporters, he said, today was a step forward and a win for the American people. Well, isn't that nice, Representative Graves? How would you figure that? Well, I guess if you think Obamacare is going to cause the death of the Republic, indeed. Indeed you would. And have you seen that ad where a horrible-looking Uncle Sam becomes a woman's gynecologist and it says, keep the government out of health care? Well, what do we figure out one time? I don't have the figures in front of me right now. Isn't about 50% of the country already has government health care? Let's see. Who do we want to take it away from? Oh, well, I know a lot of you, but let's take it away from all those poor people on Medicaid. Because if they can't help themselves, well, that's their problem. Because anybody can become Bill Gates, right? Particularly in this economic climate. Why don't they just go out and get a better job? Well, there's no talking to those people. Unfortunately, they're in a minority. 23% of Americans only, these are the crazoid Tea Party types, want to defund Obamacare, or want the government to shut down in order to defund Obamacare. So, you know, three-quarters of us have retained our sanity. But, see, here's why we need Jalene here. A loss there was a thought that was important. Okay. Mom used to say, if it's important, You will think, well, I got some exclamation points here. Okay, Boner, the Speaker of the House, says the law is a train wreck. It's time to protect American families from this unworkable law. Well, they've tried to make it unworkable. We will see. The House's stopgap funding measure would finance the government through December 15th at the current spending levels, which reflect the automatic spending cuts that took effect in March, known as sequestration, while blocking the health care law, under which the uninsured will be enrolled beginning on October 1st. Now, you know, many of you who don't follow this, and I wouldn't blame you one bit. I mean, it's a dirty job. I mean, I'm get paid to do it. So understand that what this all means. The automatic spending cuts, this was the sequestration. This is going to wind up, if these cuts are made permanent, up to almost 1 million jobs lost. And one of the things are, I said the Republicans are the party of wreck and ruin. They are willing to let the economy almost go totally in the crapper. They sent it in the crapper with Reaganomics and Bush's stewardship. Remember that in 2007? And now, I mean, they've blocked every possible remedial policy that that Obama has put into place, because what they want by 2014, and certainly by 2016, they want the economy to really be awful, because then people will spin the revolving door and say, well, Obama didn't do what he was said he was going to do. He didn't fly to the moon and cure cancer and everything like that. So I'm going to vote for the Republicans, and you can get some right-wing creature in there that will take us to war and will increase what we see with the rich getting richer and all the rest of us getting poorer. And that's what the statistics show. There's a couple of you waiting. Let me get you on the air, though. 313-298-WRIF. I haven't even looked at who you all are. But let's see. Here is Trey. Trey's in Sterling Heights. Hey, Trey. Hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
How's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for calling in. What's up?
I want to start off with saying I agree with a few things that you say. It's not so much about the Republicans wanting to say it's going to end us and, you know, everything's going to go bankrupt. It's more the theory. The theory is nice, but the problem is where are they going to get the money from? They want to pass out saying, hey, it's going to be free. Nothing's free. I don't think anybody out there, you know, is that stupid to believe that everything's free or anything's free.
No, they've got all these ways it's going to be financed, and the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, says it'll work. I think that healthy skepticism about government programs is absolutely necessary. And to think, our problems are solved now because the government is stepping in. On the other hand, we've seen that the private sector has no willingness to do it. I mean, the private sector sent the economy into the dump, and they're continuing on their merry way, making billions, in fact, trillions, while the average person's getting nowhere. So I agree we should look at it very skeptically and see how it all works for us.
Yeah, see, the thing is, though, is what's going to happen is they're going to increase the taxes to be able to pay for it.
Well, they can't. They literally cannot increase the taxes, because that would have to come from the House. At least they couldn't do it. You would have to have a Democratic majority after 2014, beginning in 2015. The seats now in the House of Representatives are so unrepresentative because the Republicans have taken part in this process called gerrymandering, where they rig all the districts to guarantee Republican seats, like in the last election. Here we got this big Republican majority, right? Except the majority of American people who voted in House elections, and someone maybe can call in with the figures, that the Democrats won the popular vote for the House of Representatives, yet wound up 30 or 40 votes shy. So the only way that taxes can be raised would be through the House. And this looks like this stalemate is going to go on endlessly.
Yeah, it's going to keep going back and forth. I mean, Obama's been shooting for his health care plan. For three times, he got knocked down twice, and he finally shoved it down everybody's throat.
Well,
the thing is, they're going to...
Well, wait. How does he shove it down people's throat if the Congress votes for it? It's not exactly shoving it down people's throats.
Well, you can't set a bill up one time, gets denied, then reword it, send it back up, gets denied, then reword it again, and then go, oh, well, okay. That's what happened.
Well, the representative, whatever. I mean, I suppose I don't know. I mean, I'm not real fond of the phrase, but whatever, it's the law. Do you fall into that category at all that would benefit from it?
I'm sorry. Would you
benefit at all from Obamacare? Do you have private insurance now or?
No. No. I like the theory of the Obamacare. Everybody gets free health care. But there's more issues to it. It's not just about the money. It's about them going to have to increase the taxes to pay for this. It's got the difference between nationalities. You know, you and I both aren't going to have the same health plan.
Yeah.
You can't. We're not the same people, so the same health plan's not going to work. Eventually, the doctors are going to get sick and tired of doing the work for nothing, because that's what it's going to turn out to be. They're not going to get paid as much as they want.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the fact that some surgeons get millions and millions where other people don't have any health insurance and can't afford their services, doesn't really trouble me. But how does this work in every other industrialized country in the world? And we, being the wealthiest country in the world, don't seem to be able to pull it off, in your estimation.
Well, I mean, we're really not the wealthiest. I mean, we're how many trillions in debt right now?
No, the more wealth the country has, I'm not saying the United States government, I'm saying the aggregate wealth of Americans makes it the richest country in the world.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I agree.
I mean, the 400 richest Americans now have $2 trillion in wealth between 400 people. I mean, well, look at this. What's wrong with this? Leave each of them with $2 million, which is a fortune that I'm sure neither you nor I could imagine having access to. And that would make about $800 million, and which you do a rounding, and you have $2 trillion. There's everything you need for every crowded school, every bankrupt city, every health care plan, everything that it should, rather than just having it parked in these guys' portfolios.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I mean, put yourself in their shoes. I mean, do you believe that you should pay more for a hamburger than the average person because you're rich?
Well, I don't know. I'm not arguing by analogies is always tough. The wealthy obviously want to keep their wealth. Some of them do all sorts of philanthropy, like Gates, the Gateses, and Bloomberg, and people like that. But in the meantime, it all has to do where is wealth parked in this society, and if it's parked so disproportionately, more than it has been since the 1920s, in the hands of people that can't even use it to consume. It's not a matter of consuming. If you have like a family, like the Waltons, who never did a bit of work in their life, the heirs, and have $120 billion, which is more money than lots of countries, have, what do you do with it? I don't know. You can do this big art museum like one of the Waltons are, but ultimately you just have it in these portfolios. In the meantime, people are scrambling around at the margins, demanding like $10 an hour rather than $7.75. Something's wrong here. All right, Trey, thank you very much. Let's see. Here is Austin in Dearborn Heights. Thanks for joining me. It's 313-298-WRIF. You think that Trey is misled?
Yeah, I'm a healthcare worker, and I'm also someone who, at the time of going through cancer, I was privately insured, but, 23-year-old young man. I don't think there's a problem financing it. I think America's found ways to finance, great programs before. Like the previous caller said, it's a great program, but we just simply don't have logistics. We don't have the medical professionals to handle the influx of all the people who will have health insurance all of a sudden. We won't. Every doctor, every nurse, every physician's assistant, nurse practitioner, nurse midwife right now has 12,000 patients plus. And you can't expect great quality medical care being one of 12,000.
Well, you know, people can still get private. You know, you don't have to. Your doctor does not have to take on more patients, and there should be. I think I've used. I'm not going to use me as an example because it sounds kind of grody. But if you go to like an ear doctor and you say, "Gee, I can't hear anymore," and the doctor comes and cleans your ears out, and then he charges whoever your insurer like $250 for the 10 minutes he spent with you. Well, you could say he's had all this training and all that, but this obviously should be done by a nurse or a nurse practitioner, or and billed out considerably lower. But again, how do other countries and it's not that our size, because you know that the other countries have proportionally less people, they have less people and proportionally less healthcare. People. I mean, whatever happened to the idea that the United States can do things, and why should it be that the people on the bottom are the ones that get screwed out of the capacity to have any health care?
That's a great point, and I'm not arguing with you on that. You know, I've worked quite a few places in my time, one of which was at the Renaissance Center right next to the Tunnel to Canada, and comparing to other countries, Canada is our most immediate neighbor to the north.
Sure.
You'd be surprised at how many people were coming across the border for medical attention because they're quote unquote put to the back of the line because,
You know, that's one of the biggest myths around. That I know, I can't begin to tell you how many Canadians that I know. And the fact that a Canadian would come over here uninsured, having to spend thousands and thousands of dollars for some medical procedure, and to the extent, let me say, to the extent that the Canadian healthcare system does not provide every single thing that a Canadian, and hey, Canadians, why don't you call in, 313-298-WRIF. The problem that if there are any with the Canadian healthcare system is that it's underfunded, and it could be funded properly if the right-wing government of Stephen Harper wouldn't be spending billions on warships to patrol the open waters now, the Arctic and all that. It's a matter of priorities. Do you want your people to have good health care? Do you want to have battleships? Do you want to have fancy planes and all that? So you can fight who? Nobody. Nobody. It's just insane militarism that is sucking money out of what could go either for lower taxes on Canadians or better health care than they have currently. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Please, this show could be called the Myth Busters, right? That, you know, there very possibly could be Canadians come over here really wealthy because remember, the United States has the best health care in the world. The best health care in the world, if you can afford it. If you can afford it. It has one of the worst. It has one of the worst health care systems in the world. We'll talk a little bit about the Lions when we come back. Whoa, we can talk sports.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Weekend, brought to you by MetroPCS. At MetroPCS, get everything you want for $40, period. Taxes and regulatory fees included. The Rick.
These days, when I'm in a relationship, I feel like I'm alone.
Like there's no one behind the mask. No voice on the other end of the line. Are you looking for a car insurance policy totally devoted to you? At Geico.com, you'll find a sympathetic ear, a shoulder to cry on, butterfly kisses, and easy ways to pay your bill and manage your policy. We're waiting with bated breath to help you save money and talk about your feelings. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Betsy, look at these sweaters. They look amazing on our girls.
Maybe.
come on. What's wrong?
Suzanne, I have no business being in the store. I should not be shopping. Things are really tight. We're behind on our mortgage.
Listen, Bill and I had the same problem, and we got some really great counseling, and it was free. I'm going to email you the information.
If you even think you may be in danger of foreclosure, call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling today at 866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org. Public service from the NFCC.
101 WRIF. Oh.
Opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Jolene.
All right, thank you very much, Peter. Without Jolene, Jolene, out in the cold, a little chilly today, out of Metro Beach at the boat show. She's broadcasting live, and really, she came over to our house and didn't look good and called in. And when she doesn't... when she doesn't come in to do night call, believe it, she's under the weather. Thanks for a lot of your good wishes at our email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, my website, peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, And most importantly, our phone number here at WRIF, 313-298-WRIF. I said I was going to get on to the Lions, and I bet you're wondering why we hardly ever talk about sports. It had to do with the game today, yeah. The Lions beat Washington 27-20, 22 times before, 21 times before. The Lions had lost in Washington, so this is pretty good. But I wanted to talk about the name, the Washington Redskins. There's a lot of controversy about that, a lot of objections. And I thought we were going to leave it about the health care, but people want to talk about it, so I am very pleased to do that. In fact, I'm very interested to hear, particularly for people that don't have health insurance and now can become eligible for it. October 1st is when people need to start enrolling in healthcare, and you go to healthcare.gov. The Republicans are doing everything they can to sabotage the bill, defunding it, trying to hold the government funding hostage. You know, the government will be unable to pay its bills after just a week unless it's funded, and the Republicans say they're holding the government hostage. In the meantime, the Republicans are doing everything they can to destroy the health care law, saying it will destroy the republic. The law is a train wreck. It's not quite clear how it will do anything like that. But the states, including Michigan, tried to undercut the law, although I think in Michigan now has its insurance exchanges set up. So if you go to healthcare.gov, you can figure this all out. But one of the things, Trey said that Canada had really bad health care, and we've got at least one person on the air. But remember, you know, private health care, ever have any complaints about that? Ever had any complaints about a hospital you've been to, private hospital? Ever had any complaints about a private doctor? Any bureaucracy is going to have its problems. Let's go to Will in Canada. Will, hi, you're on the air with me. Welcome.
Good evening, Peter. Thank you very much. I'm calling from Windsor, Ontario, and of course I'm under the universal health care system. About 4 years ago, I suffered a motorcycle accident. I did not have private insurance because I'm a small business owner. I had significant nerve and spinal damage, which required 4 surgeries, which were all done in Windsor here over a 2.5-year period, and they were all successful, with the exception of a little finger, baby finger in my left hand that still is numb. I'd say 95% recovery. We have very, very good doctors here. And I did not have to wait. And every 2 months, I have it's called a rhizotomy for guys over 50, and I'm 59 years old. The lower back tends to go. And some people suffer from a lot of sciatic nerve pain. And every 2 months, I go in, I have these injections, and steroid injections in the base of my spine. They're very painful, but when I come out, I can carry on. I'm weightlifting. I can play with my kids. I can chase my dog. And without those, without exaggeration, I would be on a cane. My quality of life would go down about 75%.
Let me ask you this. A lot of people in Michigan, I don't know if it's other states as well, they say that just tons of people come to the United States because the Canadian healthcare system, the public healthcare system, just doesn't work. Do you know of people that come to the United States?
Yes. And I think a lot of misconception is this, is that sometimes in Windsor in particular, our best heart surgery is done in London, Ontario, which is about a 2-hour drive from here. If someone has a heart attack here and there's immediate life-threatening, they need an immediate life procedure, and the doctor in Windsor is either preoccupied or they're not available, they will ambulance them over to Detroit if they're worried that the trip to London may take too long to get them. Mm-hmm. So they will move them over to Detroit, have the procedure done there, and then OHIP, which is Ontario Hospitalization Insurance Program, will then pay the American River Hospital at Henry Ford for the procedure. And it's strictly the patient's condition. Can they make the trip? Can they be helicoptered out or flown out to London in time? Or would it be more beneficial to save their life in such imminent danger that it's faster to get them over to Detroit? So that does happen periodically. But again, it's paid for, and it's not that we don't have the capability. It's just that patient's particular condition. But those are rare. any other procedure, they do heart surgeries here as well, but any other procedure I've ever had done, I've had a few in my life, has been done here, hernias, you name it, and I've never paid a dime. In fact, we have Americans come up to Toronto to the Schulbeis Clinic, their world-renowned, it's a world-renowned clinic. All they do is hernias, types of hernias, and a lot of your Mennonites will come up from Philadelphia and Illinois to have and pay to have the procedure done in Toronto because they're so good. But if you're Canadian, you get it done free of charge. I know.
Wow.
Because I've had it and I've never had to go back. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is we do have a very good system here, and the quality of health care is very, very good.
Well, it is indeed. Maybe I should have thought about it, because even though I have insurance from this company, from Greater Media, that owns WRIF, I still had to pay, I don't know, like $1,000. And I thought maybe these, like this hernia surgery I had, I thought, I don't know. I thought maybe it would cost like $800 or $900, you know, that, and it turned, I saw the bill. It was like $10,000, to do this.
Yeah.
You know what I could have done? Oh, I mean, I didn't have to pay the $10,000, but a lot of these procedures, American hospital costs and surgery costs are so expensive that oftentimes you can do well to pay for it on yourself, fly to another country that you'd like to go to, like France or England or some nice city in Canada, and get your surgery done and enjoy a vacation. Of course, if you're having an operation, that's something. But thank you for that, Will. I appreciate you clearing that up. I just think, like I said, it needs myth-busting. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Let's see, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Melissa. She's around New Boston in Michigan. Go ahead, Melissa. You're on the air.
Thank you. Well, you know what? Because I've been listening to all that.
Yeah.
And you know what? I have health insurance through Michigan, which is I'm going to tell you exactly what it is. It is called 4-Star through Wayne County. And I have torn discs in my back and everything. And no, I cannot get this help here in Michigan.
You cannot what?
Okay. I can't get that help in here in Michigan. Okay, I can't even get physical therapy under this insurance that I have, and they say that's what I need.
Huh.
Okay. All right. When you have a back problem and you have disc problems, sometimes they get crippling.
Sure.
Okay. Yes. They're getting, mine are getting crippling every day.
That's terrible.
And
of course, like I say, it stands to reason. People, everybody accepts it at every level of society that it's the farther you are in down in the economic scale, the less you're going to get. I mean, not only are you, I don't mean you particularly, Melissa, but anyone who's not getting paid well. I mean, that's bad enough. You can't afford everything. There's glittering advertisements for all these commodities. You can't afford them. Sometimes if, you know, you can't afford them for your kids and what have you. And you get bad medical insurance. And people just sort of take that for granted. I don't get it. All right, Melissa, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I remember what I was going to say a little earlier that I said I forgot, and that is somewhere around 50% of Americans already get government health insurance. And I may have said that, but what I wanted to get at is who do you want to strip it away from if you think it shouldn't? How about our veterans, right? They're socialized medicine. The government pays for their health care. And do they have complaints? Some think, I've talked to different vets, some, because all of us have complaints. People that have had great hospitalization and medical insurance have gone to a hospital and something's gone wrong or something like that. So it's not like, and they're bureaucracy. So wherever there's bureaucracy, whether it's private or public, there's going to be problems without a doubt. I mean, there's always going to be human error. There's always going to be red tape. I mean, that goes with the territory. But who wants to strip? And I'll bet you there are some right-wing conservatives that, they're pretty militaristic. But some of them say that the state, the federal government, the political state should do nothing like that. So do we want to strip it away from the vets? I don't think so. How about our aged, people over 65, that's socialized medicine. That's just like they have in Canada or other countries. Because in this case, if you want full coverage under Medicare, you have to have a supplemental program, so you have to put out something for that. You can have it subtracted from your Social Security. I don't even know what it is, $60-something dollars a month or maybe more. Someone could tell me that. But then, of course, there's Medicaid, and that's the poor. And so then you have the mean-spirited people that are grouped vastly disproportionately among Republicans and conservatives and libertarians and what have you, who don't think that that kind of health care should be provided to people that are unfortunate at all. Unfortunate in that they haven't been able to share in the congealed wealth of the 400 people, in the richest 400 people in the United States, that whose total wealth is $2 trillion. That if we're left with 2 million apiece, and does that seem too communistic, only taking away their money, their billions, and only leaving them with 2 million? Okay, we don't want to go too commie on you. How about leaving them with 5 million? So what's that? So that would be like 2 billion. Rounding it off, there's still $2 trillion to raise the minimum wage, to take care of the schools, our roads, you know, all of that. It's all there. And someone who was a trade was talking about financing. You could do that by confiscating a lot of the wealth, which should be, you can have a confiscatory tax on income, on accumulated wealth. Not even talking about income tax, but on accumulated wealth. Like, where is Bill Gates's $45 billion? He gives a lot of away, does a lot of stuff. He couldn't give it away if he tried. If he said, this is obscene. This is obscene that people make $7.25 an hour for working their butt off. And so I'm going to start doing all these incredible programs around education and disease and all that. All that he and Melinda, his wife, do. So, and congratulate to them. But say he said, I want to give it all away. Like, what was the guy? I can't think of his name that started Domino's Pizza. I always block on his name. Right winger. But he said he wants to die poor. He's giving it all to the Catholic Church and all that. But if Bill and Melinda Gates wanted to give it all away and just be left with $2 million, I don't think they could do it. I mean, they could write a check to somebody for, you know, for $45 billion, but you can't even do it. It's in the nature of the policies, the economic policies, the taxation policies, that allow that accumulation of wealth in the upper 1%. And that's not even the biggies. The 1%, I think you got to be in the top 1%. I don't know. I think it's maybe over $375,000. You know, not, I mean, for most of us, a particularly high sum if we had that a year. But it's not great. Where it is in the 0.1%, that's where the Sheldon Adelmans and the Koch brothers and the rest of those creatures from the Black Lagoon come from, right? Okay, I think we'll do this one quick, but let's try it. Here's Truk from the planet Mars. Truk, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Well, thank you.
Doing pretty good. I hope Julie gets well pretty soon.
Sure, me too. Thanks.
But you're wanting to talk about health care and Bill Gates and stuff like that and one percenters.
Is that, sure.
That's
sure.
The
Go
deal
ahead.
Tonight?
Go ahead.
So basically what I've got coming up here is like people from Canada, what they have to do, because, I mean, they have the Ontario Health Insurance Program, like as previously mentioned by that other guy.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware that, you know, that was covered because from what I understood, people had to pay in order to go to, stateside hospitals, right? Because that's all private over there, right?
Yeah, no, it's public over there. But if you lived in Windsor and you said, I want to go, you know, it could be, one of the things I hear, if it's not emergency, you might have to wait. Like, you know, I needed hernia surgery. So I picked a time right in between the league play that I do for my handball league. So, you know, I did it at my convenience and the surgeon slotted me in. Could be that, I think it was Trey said that if it was in Canada, I'd put it on a list and do it, you know, when it came up in order. If I said, you know, here I live in Windsor and I want it done right away, I would go to the United States and I could have, all I got to do is put down my $10,000 and then I would have the surgery when I want it. But in the main, Canadians, I'm sure 99% of Canadians get that done in Canada. The medical insurance is good, and it works for them. Why we are scrambling around, and I wish there's got to be some Republicans listening that could say why John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, thinks that the law is a train wreck, and while these conservatives say it's going to destroy the Republic. Let me tell you, even if it doesn't work well, even if it is a train wreck, it's not going to do anything to the Republic. And what it would mean would be that if it doesn't work well, it would have to be fixed because, as I said, the Republicans have done everything they could to make it go badly. So those things would have to be altered if, in fact, they don't work well. All right, Truk, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Well, we will do this, and there's a couple of things I want to talk about, including another mass murder, the world home of mass murders, the United States. Go to my website. There's a great photograph on there that was put on, that was there before. I mean, I think it must have happened on Monday because it was up there before. Why can't I see what I want to see? Oh, man. Where's Jolene now that I need her? Here. That it's got these guys that are standing, all look middle-aged or older. They all have their hands over their hearts, must be saying the Pledge of Allegiance, and they have this big sign. This was published on Monday, right before the latest mass murder in Washington, D.C. at the Navy Yard, and they have this big sign that says, "Guns save lives. Guns save lives." And then another incident, one more time. And I'll talk about that. You can look at that at Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, PeterWerbe.com, also at our Facebook page, Facebook.com/Night Call. But let me see, do I have time to set this up? Yeah. As I said, the Lions beat Washington 27-20. This was after 22 tries in the nation's capital. But there's been a lot of pressure on the Redskins to change their name because, pardon me, that their name, Redskins, I mean, most Native people consider that. In fact, probably all Native people. I might get somebody say, I don't care. But most Native people consider Redskins, hey, them pesky Redskins, right? Yeah, you know, they were pesky. They really resented the European invasion because, you know, they were so crazy that they actually thought we were going to take over all their land. And so they became kind of pesky. But here, this is in the Detroit News. And it says, in 1755, when the United States was just 13 colonies, Spencer Phipps, a lieutenant governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, called for British settlers to kill Native Americans who resisted. Instead of bringing the bodies of the Penobscot Indian Nation who lived in what is now Maine as proof of the slaying, settlers could return instead with scalps of the men, women, and children that they attacked and killed, and those red skins earned them as much as 50 pounds, which was an extraordinary amount there. So why are these teams all over the United States and Canada as well called things like the Redskins, they have different tribal names, the Warriors, and they have a drawing of a Native American? It's because they are portrayed as savages. They have this strength. They have this ferocity. They have this savagery, where really the savagery was on the part of the European invaders and occupiers and ethnic cleansers. There were any number of cases. I shouldn't say cases. It was popular to make a tobacco pouch out of an Indian woman's breast. Yeah, you heard me right. That some of these settlers and these invaders would make tobacco pouches out of a dead Indian woman's breast. European society, by the time that they had almost destroyed Europe with their religiosity and their environmental destruction and their hundreds of years of war, the insanity, the leprosy that swept there, and rather than solving their own problems in Europe, they came to this country. And they met, remember I mentioned this before, is that Columbus meets these people almost naked, and there the sailors from Europe are armored, both psychoanalytically armored, psychologically armored, and physically armored as well. And rather than throwing off their armor, looking how these Taino people live, the people that they first met when they were discovered by them, Columbus writes in his journal, the first night, they will make excellent servants. This is the kind of mentality that was exported from Europe. It was a cruel society, and it exterminated the people that lived here in the greatest ethnic cleansing that ever occurred. All right, listen, call me about that or call me more about healthcare. One of the things I wonder is people, that you don't have health insurance now. What are you going to do? You're supposed to register. You're supposed to sign up at these exchanges. You going to do it? What does it all mean? And you're probably saying, I don't know. Well, we're going to have to figure it out real quick. I'll be back with more after these.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At Geico.com, that someone is a car insurance policy, and the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Speak. Countless love was on
office.
I applied right from day one.
Get tricked.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Dan, you're going to Las Vegas.
Whoa, yeah.
We'll see you in sunny Las Vegas as Sin City Takeover with 101 The Rift.
Yes. WRIF's Sin City Takeover 2013. Learn more and sign up for your totally unfair Rift Cyber Crew advantage now at WRIF.com.
I want to hit the Rift.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Rift award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to our second hour. I say hour, Peter and Jolene, but Jolene off tonight under the weather, unfortunately. And 313-298-WRIF. Most of the first hour, we were talking about health care, the fact that it's coming right up at us. And, in fact, it says on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, the Obamacare Health Insurance Marketplace is coming October 1st. A new way to get affordable coverage, and if you click there, it takes you to healthcare.gov, and it'll tell you what you need to know. A lot of you will qualify for subsidized policies, which is pretty good. Well, I would say excellent. I was talking about before the break. Oh, let me tell you what's going to happen at 1 a.m. This, a little typographical error here on my website. You know, probably if I didn't tell you this, most of you wouldn't even know it. But, you know, full disclosure always. These are two what we call archive shows from about a year ago. And so I was putting them into the system that plays them. And, you know, I've done them before and read the books and all that. So I don't listen to them. Somehow I wound up listening because I have to record in real time to both these. Both of these, if someone said, Pete, give me a couple of your best interviews, and it ain't about me. It's not about me. It's about the people who I'm interviewing. This would be two of the better ones. First one is with Wayne Kramer, who was the former lead guitar for Detroit's MC5. Wayne Kramer, considered by Rolling Stone magazine one of the top 100 guitarists ever. And he discussed his, the history of the band, that his absolutely incredible influence on so many other bands around the world. Also, his imprisonment, his drug use, and how that led to something called Jail Guitar Doors. Jail Guitar Doors. That was a song by The Clash that actually referenced Wayne going to jail for about 2.5 years for cocaine. And Jail Guitar Doors is a program that provides guitars for inmates, get them, you know, doing something other than, you know, something good inside the joint. The other one with Larry Tai, who wrote this book called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, and, you know, the man of steel who supports truth, justice, and the American way, and why it has been so enduring. Both of them are incredible interviews. And, well, let me put it this way. That sounds like it's me. Both of my guests, Wayne Kramer of the MC5 and Larry Tai, the author of the Superman book, incredible guests. All right, we're talking about Detroit Lions beating Washington. They're named the Redskins. And I was saying earlier how this term, Redskins, is insulting to all Indian people, although Indian people, Native American people, probably even a better way to say it. And, in fact, it says here in this article from the Detroit News, to many Native Americans, it's probably the best way to say to many, because there's probably someone who says, I don't care. That's cool. That is the image they see, and the image that I mentioned before about how the term Redskins was where the Massachusetts Bay Colony in the mid-18th century would pay for the scalps of men, women, and children that they killed, and that those Redskins could be turned in. Scalping was initiated by the European colonists. This was not a a Native American tradition. They took it up after who they called, Scalper Washington, George Washington's troops, when he was involved in Indian suppression before he was creating our free republic. He did his duty to his homeland, England. Anyway, to many Native Americans, that's the image they see when they hear about the Washington Redskins, the NFL team that is under increasing pressure to change its long-held team name. Let's see. Frank Claudier, spokesman for the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe, which the Central American University Chippewa is their name. That's okay with them. And they use it. They do educational programs. but still, I mean, that's up to them, of course, their name. But the impression is, and that's why it's used so frequently, is the Indians were savages. Where really, the European invaders, the colonists, were the real savages, the real murderers, the ethnic cleansers. Did Indians do stuff back? Yeah. Did they sometimes do kind of not so pleasant things when they had their little disputes? Yeah, but never on a grand scale. How many native people were swept away so Europe could bring its problems here? About 30 million. I mean, that kind of dwarfs the Holocaust of modern times, right? Over the past year, the debate about the Redskins has gained traction, says the Detroit News. Last week, the Washington Post editorial board suggested the team change the name because it, quote, is a racial slur of Native Americans so offensive that it should no longer be tolerated. Now, the owner, who is the owner? His name is Snyder, must appear in here somewhere ahead of time. But anyway, Snyder, whose team hosts the Detroit Lions at Washington's FedEx Field on Sunday, said, has been defiant. We'll never change the name, he told USA Today. It's that simple. Never. You can use capital letters to say it. Where did they just miss this? No, it is. I can't find the man's name. Couldn't be our governor. No, it's not Governor Snyder. Okay, well, I think they just left it out. Oh, no. Daniel Snyder. Here it is. In a parenthesis, no doubt. Multiple national sports columnists, including Sports Illustrated Peter King and USA Today's Christine Brennan, have said they will no longer use the team's name. I said it. Well, I'll say it one more time. It's Redskin. The idea is that it should be gotten rid of it, that it's a slur. Like, for instance, would they call it the Washington Blacks or the Washington Jews? Or the Washington Italians or the Washington Greeks? Now, the reason that they wouldn't use that is it wouldn't have any real meaning. I mean, if you called the football team, changed the name from the Washington Redskins to the Washington Jews or the Washington Italians, people would go, what the hell does that mean? But when you say Redskins, when you say Warriors, well, Warriors is kind of inherent. But when you use these tribal names, this isn't for the United States, but the Wayne State teams used to be called the Tartars, T-A-R-T-A-R, who were these people of Northern Asia or East Asia, I guess. And they used to have this, what they called then, Oriental caricature. Again, this ferocity that knew no boundaries. Let's see, the National Congress of American Indians, the oldest and largest American Indian and Alaska Native organization, opposes Redskins and any race-based name. The Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin, who has nearly 17,000 members, opposes such names as well. And according to Brandon Stevens, a councilman for the Oneida Tribe in Wisconsin, said, any race-based mascot is offensive in the nature that we are subjected to a mascot along with animals, inanimate objects, and those things that we're compared to. It's the mindset that we can be a mascot, that we're like a puppet to show someone else is strong because we didn't go down without a fight. That's not the sentiment we want. Well, they did go down with a fight, didn't they? Just didn't work out well. And what's been done to Native people, of course, we all go, yeah, what a terrible tragedy. All right. Nobody gives a good god darn. Okay. Let's go on to the gun thing. And somebody waiting a long time wanted to talk about that. I said on the, let's see the date on this. Pardon me. Where is my date here? Anyway, pardon me. This photograph in the New York Times shows these middle-aged and older men with their hands over their hearts. And his huge sign is his guns save lives. Unfortunately, it came out right the day before the Washington Navy Yard massacre. I mean, who believes such stupidity? You can make all the arguments in the world for why you have the constitutional right to bear arms, why you want it, why you think it's good for you and all that. But is there anybody that thinks that guns save more lives than they take? Statistically, that's absolutely nonsense. But let's see what Scott in Westland has to say about it all. Scott, hi. Thanks for your patience, and welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Pete. Well, I have three quick things I want to raise about gun control in the light of the Navy Yard shooting. One is just very common sense. Why was there no metal detector at this Navy Yard? It's a military base. High school students have to walk through metal detectors. This guy was able to just waltz in there with a 12-gauge shotgun, and he wasn't searched or anything like that. But again, I don't know the answer to that question. The other one, second point I'd like to make, is there's genuinely cruel irony in the idea that this Nidal Hassan, who's currently on trial for the Fort Hood shooting, was a psychiatrist. And I've noticed that all...
You're right. That's very strange. He needed one.
I noticed that all the intellectual pundits in the media seem to have really avoided that fact. And again, yes, when I think about it, it's genuinely frightening, and I don't know what to say about it. The third point I'd like to make is, and this is a little scary, is that in this latest shooting, the Navy Yard shooting, the weapon, this Remington 870, ironically, isn't even on my left-wing liberal list of what would be considered an assault weapon. Basically, it was just a pump shotgun with an internal tubular magazine, and it fits my rule of reloading one round at a time. It doesn't have a big detachable box magazine like an AR-15 or whatever. And so,
one of the arguments was that if people would have been armed, that they could have dealt with him, which is a nonsensical argument, of course. But he had the shotgun, but then the other two weapons, which were handguns, were taken from the guards at the Navy complex. So he was able to disarm people that were armed. Those were the good guys. Remember, that's what that crazed head of the NRA says, that this stops when good guys with guns stop bad guys with guns. Well, yeah, usually after they've done a lot of damage, an organized police force comes and deals with it. But, the AR-15 is the mass murder weapon of choice, without a doubt.
You may have heard of the Ionia road rage incident that happened recently.
Tell us about that, but I wanted to set that up as one of the things to refute this insanity of the sign that these people are holding. That says that guns save lives. Well, here's a couple of armed guys in Ionia, Michigan. Go ahead. Tell us about it, Scott.
Okay. Two middle-aged guys got into some kind of road rage altercation near Ionia, Michigan. They pulled off the road and got into a verbal argument, which escalated. And then these are both people who had legal concealed weapons permits. They both pulled out their guns and shot each other. And both were killed.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was at the Wonder Wand car wash. And incidents like that happen all the time. In fact, counting how many mass murderers there are in this country is a lot depending on how you count it. For one thing, the government, the FBI doesn't count mass murders. For instance, if there's two people killed and 11 people wounded, they don't consider it a mass murder. It'd have to be, much more there. So I have no idea how to solve the problem of the mass insanity around guns. There's no way that guns are going to be confiscated. The fact that the shooter, remind me of his name. Do you have it at your fingertips?
No.
Okay.
The Navy Yard, no.
Yeah, he couldn't. He wanted an AR-15, but because of the demand for background checks, he couldn't get it right away. So why these people don't want a background check is pretty crazy. All right. Well, I wouldn't say what I mean by hang on. Just listen a little more, and we'll talk more about this. So the idea that guns save lives that these people are holding just gets thrown into insanity almost every time. Let's see. Also here, Western Michigan authorities say a shootout outside a social club has killed two men and a woman in Muskegon and left five others with gunshot wounds. Muskegon police authorities got a call about 2 a.m. Sunday saying there was gunfire at the Elks Charity Lodge. These are the law-abiding citizens. They say, all these laws are just going to, inhibit law-abiding citizens. Well, they're all law-abiding citizens until they start shooting themselves or shooting each other or doing anything else like that. The worst thing is a new spate of gun violence in Chicago left four men dead on Saturday, less than 2 days after a shooting spree at a park in a city that wounded, that in a 13 people wounded, 13 people, including a three-year-old boy. The latest shootings came as America's third most populous city struggled to respond to a rash of street violence that killed seven people in less than 30 hours. Let me tell you this. Where do these people get their guns? I mean, part of it is because of very, very lax controls on them. I have a neighbor that is, I don't know if I would call her a survivalist, but she's got that mentality, always got these very bizarre bumper stickers on her truck and all this, and flies the American and the Michigan flag. I always go by her house and ask her, I say, hey, can I register to vote here? You know, it looks like a government office. But in any event, guess what happened the other day? Someone broke into her house and stole her cache of guns. I mean, she had, I don't know how many. She had quite a few, though, from what I understand. Somebody knew right where they were, right? Because they apparently that's the only thing they took, and they were not just laying around the living room. So where are her guns right now? Do you think they are someplace in the hands of a so-called law-abiding citizen? She has just armed a whole bunch of criminals because of her possession of this. And do we even have to talk about what's happening in Kenya right now? I don't think so. Starbucks, by the way, has asked, they've taken out these big ads, and they've, Aaron Alexis of Texas, that's his name. That was a shooter in the Washington Navy Yard, that Starbucks is asking customers to leave firearms behind when they're in its stores and its outdoor seating areas. Howard Schultz, the executive, chief executive of Starbucks, said in a telephone interview, customers in many stores have been jarred and fairly uncomfortable to see guns in our stores, not understanding the issue and feeling that guns should not be part of the Starbucks experience, especially when small kids are around. Under the change, baristas and other store employees will not ask customers to, who come in with guns in holsters, say, to leave or confront them in any way. No signs explaining the policy will be posted in Starbucks stores either. So how the hell are they supposed to know this? I got to tell you, when do you guys walk into a Starbucks with a displaying a gun? I know, you know, probably who knows how many people they concealed. I'm out of there. Because anybody that wants to do that and has no concern with how uncomfortable they make people feel, I think at some level, at least some of them are capable of almost anything. Why somebody of all the problems of this world feel the need to intimidate other people, to feel that they've got to flaunt this deadly weapon, and someone who's had minimal training in all of this, you know, that's going to walk around with their gun showing. I'm just taking me and mine, get out of there. But here, anyway, I want to get to, we mentioned that thing about the Washington team is being asked to get rid of its name of the Redskins as offensive to Native people. Here's Andrew calling from Ontario. Andrew, hi. It says you're Native American. How do you feel about that?
Yes, sir. I'm a Kanawagi Mohawk from Canada.
Uh-huh.
I'm non-status. I'm a couple generations removed. Unfortunately, my mom didn't get it, so I can't get it. But yeah, I don't see it's a problem. It's a maybe it's a conversation piece for the younger generation who don't know so much about it, and they ask, you know, Redskin, Dad, what's that? And then he can go on to explain it. Because in school in Canada, at least. That was something that was just kind of glazed over. We didn't learn too much about that.
Well, why do you think Dad would know all of that? I bet you 90% of, I bet you 99.9%, maybe even including me, didn't know the origins of that term Redskins and the fact that those pelts, that's how the colonists, the European invaders and occupiers, the ethnic cleansers saw the people that were there rather than cooperating with them. I mean, they did. They made all sorts of alliances to fight the French, or the French made alliance. You know, it was all strategic. And then when it was done, they shoved you folks onto reservations, right?
I agree with you, sir. But because Google exists, I mean, just because the dad doesn't know doesn't mean he can't Google himself.
Why does he care? I mean, he's just interested in football. I mean, if the name of the Washington teams was changed to the Washington Italians, they would say, okay, the Lions beat the Italians, right? I mean, I don't think there's any teaching moment there, to tell you the truth. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right.
I don't know. I'm going to school to become a teacher, and I feel like I'm not a father. I'm young. I'm 25. But one day when I am a father, I'm hoping that when my son or daughter asks me something like that, that I give them an honest answer instead of just glazing over a subject that they seem sincerely interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about it before you said it. Then again, it has a lot to do with my heritage.
Sure.
But I feel like we live in the information age where if you want to know about something, you can. And perhaps the name Washington Redskin is just a gateway to learning about a subject that you didn't know anything about before.
You're a much more optimistic man than I am, Andrew. Hey, let me ask you this, or in fact, if you would tell the audience, you kind of quickly went over about how your mother didn't take advantage of. I don't think the people in the States understand that process. Could you just explain it to us real quickly?
Absolutely. We have a status program in Canada where Native Americans can apply for the status card. It's actually very difficult to do. And it's basically reparations for what happened so many generations ago. Things like if you go to the store and you buy a new mattress, there's no taxes on that. It just gets rid of taxes of all sorts. Going to school.
Okay, that is if you can register as a native Canadian.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's like school is free. Getting things like a hunting license or a fishing license much easier. It's a great program if you can get into it. Unfortunately, my mother married outside of the tribe, and she took on the name McCarthy, so they no longer recognize her, and I can't get it. But my cousins, they can get it because my aunt kept her last name.
Hmm. I bet you that kind of pisses off some of the Anglophones and Francophones, so, because special privilege.
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Those closest to me really try to get me to push my mom into doing it. But other people, I thought, well, that's not fair. I was like, well, you know, maybe not from your perspective, but if you look at the people that are really, really deep into the Native heritage and what was taken from them,
mm-hmm.
then you're right, it's not fair. There's nothing will ever be enough.
All right, Andrew, it's great to hear you're becoming a teacher and you have what's necessary, that sense of investigating what it's all about. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, sir.
All right, appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. If you're just joining us, one of the things that Andrew was commenting on was that there is a demand that the Washington Redskins get rid of this racially offensive name. You can comment on that. Let's go to Ron in Shelby Township. It's 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
It's Ron in Shelby Township.
Hey, Ron.
And I just want to make a comment on guns do save lives. That is a fact. The latest FBI stats say that, now this is from 91 to 2011, because, you know, it takes about a year or so, you know, for them to compile this information. They say that crime has... you know, violent crimes have dropped 49% in the last 20 years. 49% simply because more people do have guns.
Well, Ron, you would have to show me that in writing. There's no way the Federal Bureau of Investigation is going to talk about a causal relationship. The FBI, all police chiefs, everybody involved in law enforcement, first responders want people to have less guns, not more. And there has been a decrease. You think there's actually been a major, for instance, where murders have dropped really sharply is in Manhattan. Do you really think that there's less murders in New York because people have more guns?
Guns do save lives.
Well, wait a minute. There's lots of cases. All you got to do is read the Rifleman, the NRA publication. You'll see how people save themselves, caught criminals, stop people from harming them, stop break-ins into their house. How many people have been murdered illegally? Or, well, murdered is illegal. How many people have been killed illegally in the last 20 years?
Well, it's because people don't have guns. You know, if more law-abiding citizens had guns, You know, there'd be less murders. Look at Sandy Hook, okay, for instance. This is a good example. Look at Sandy Hook. These people that are on these psychotic drugs, okay, that go on these shooting rampages, they want a high body count, okay? That's the bottom line. They want as high a body count as possible. They know if they go to a school, they are going to get that high body count. They know that nobody is going to have a gun in a gun-free school zone.
You know what? This is just, you know, NRA propaganda, man. You know what percentage of mass murders occur in gun-free zones? Less than 25%. These guys go where they think they can hurt people. They don't know whether anybody's armed or not. There's school guards that have them. But I'll tell you what. Let's do this. You go listen on the radio. I'm going to play something for you. All right. So thank you, Ron. That's the standard argument. This is Chris Hayes. Let me see if I can get this going. Where is it here? Where's Jalene now that I need her? Yeah. All right. Chris Hayes is on MSNBC, and he takes on this argument very directly, and you can comment on this. And in fact, I think what I'll do is just go right into commercial. This is about 3.5-4 minutes long, and then it will, if it works, and then we'll come back and get your opinions on it. So here's Chris Hayes. This is, it's a television program, so I don't know whether there's going to be any visuals that'll not have commentary with it, but here it goes.
Another really scary and chaotic scene Saturday night in the middle of what is probably New York City's biggest intersection. At 42nd and 8th Avenue, right near Times Square, NYPD officers were confronted by a man labeled as agitated and disoriented, who seemed to be throwing himself into the path of oncoming traffic. When police tried to subdue the man, he apparently reached into his pocket, pulled out his hand, and pretended to shoot the officers as if his hand was a gun. I'll let Police Commissioner Ray Kelly tell you what happened next.
One officer fired one shot, not striking the individual. Another officer who had responded to the scene fired two shots at the individual, also not striking him. However, two bystanders on the northeast corner of 42nd Street and 8th Avenue were struck by bullets fired by the officers.
Did you get all that? The suspect was not shot at all, but those bullets fired from police guns found their way into the bodies of two bystanders. One person was shot in the leg while the other was shot in the buttocks. Now, today, when news broke about the shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C., almost immediately, gun advocates and conservatives offered their own versions of the heroic myth made famous by the NRA's CEO, Wayne LaPierre.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Just so you know, this weekend in New York, there were some, quote, good guys with guns, trained professionals in Times Square Saturday night, who ended up putting bullets into the bodies of innocent bystanders and not into the suspect. And this is not the first time something like this has happened. About a year ago, two counterterrorism officers assigned to the Empire State Building, the kinds of officers trained to respond specifically to terrorist threats, shot and killed an armed murder suspect. But amid the chaos, 9 bystanders were also shot. An 11-year study ending in 2006 that looked at the rate in which New York police fired their guns found that officers hit their targets just 34% of the time. Now take a moment and think about the mass confusion that typifies mass shootings like the one that we saw this morning. A lot of the time, we can't tell how many shooters there are. Eyewitnesses are contradicting each other. Now add a bunch of armed citizens, not cops, but ordinary armed folks firing their weapons into that blur of panic and confusion. Take a second and think whether that's going to make things better. But that's the argument coming from some gun rights advocates. These folks claim that killers methodically and deliberately choose sites where firearms are prohibited. Gun-free zones, where there'll be nobody on hand with a gun to stop them. Almost immediately, after the Navy Yard shooting was first even reported with the smell of gun smoke still hanging over Washington, D.C., Twitter was predictably bombarded with a barrage of tweets supporting this unsubstantiated claim. Quote, strange how every single mass shooting happens in a gun-free zone. It's almost like they don't work or something. And there was this tweet from one Robert Zimmerman, brother of George Zimmerman. It's also an undeniable fact that areas sought out for the massacres are areas with strict gun control, like D.C., like today. Actually, that is deniable. A Mother Jones investigation finds that among the 62 mass shootings from 1982 to 2012, not a single case includes evidence the killer chose to target a place because it banned guns. And a study conducted by Mayors Against Illegal Guns showed that in 56 mass shootings between January 2009 and January 2013, no more than 13 of the shootings, or 23%, took place entirely in public spaces that were so-called gun-free zones. This reminded me of the exchange following the Aurora movie theater shooting in Colorado when Bill O'Reilly asked Bob Costas, if Costas had been in that theater, would he rather duck down and hide or be armed and have the ability to defend himself?
I don't want to have a gun on me, no. And in that situation, in the dark, in
I
the confusion,
that.
I think it's highly more likely that there would be additional carnage. Bullets would be flying wildly all over
but
the place.
Again,
this seemingly basic logic of not having a bunch of people with loaded weapons in a crowded space is actually put into practice by the people who run gun shows. From the website of Bill Goodman's Gun and Knife Shows, for your safety, please ensure all magazines and weapons are empty before entering the show. Patrons who bring loaded magazines or weapons into the show will be refused entry and may be subject to prosecution. And I'd argue that same bedrock logic applies just as well outside of gun shows.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Attention business owners, this is Tony Robbins. I've spent the last 3 decades helping companies create serious business breakthroughs, and I want to help you like never before.
And this is Chet Holmes, author of the number one business book, The Ultimate Sales Machine. If you've heard my radio spots before, maybe you don't know that about 2,000 action-oriented business owners call us every week to get our free reports. But it was Tony Robbins that challenged me to go even further for you.
Chet and I have built a serious training program called 4 Ways to Double Sales in 12 Months.
And here's what Tony convinced me to do.
We're going to give this to any business owner who calls us at 800-936-0222. Just call with your email address, and we'll email you this phenomenal audio training program at our expense, not yours.
It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 4 ways to double sales in 12 months.
Call and leave us a voicemail with your email, and we'll give you a program that others have paid dearly to receive. Call right now. That's 1-800-936-0222.
I guess we got caught up in the crazy housing boom.
We had been in the house so long, we didn't want to lose it.
What these people share is that they all got in trouble with their mortgages, and they all called a certified housing counselor for help.
Our housing counselor looked at our paperwork, and she knew something was wrong.
She understood what needed to be done, and she helped me work it out with the bank. This is a free service. Call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling now. Call 1-866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org.
101 WRIF. Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
And one more time, Jalene is off for the evening. Caught a bit of a chill as she was broadcasting live out of Metro Beach for the boat show. Broadcast for 5 hours on a Sunday with our sister station here at the Greater Media Complex, huh? So I'm doing it all by myself. Jefferson taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Chris Hayes from MSNBC. What is it, All In? Isn't that the name of the show? Kind of blew away that argument that Ron gave that somehow, gee, if everybody was armed, wouldn't that be great? Everybody would start shooting. Well, as he said, the police frequently make mistakes, and with these large magazine pistols, rapid fire, who the hell knows what would be going on? Could it possibly be the case that that lives could be saved in certain circumstances? Sure. But you know what? I don't trust you. You know, I'm talking to you that has the gun, that dreams about being the Superman that takes out the shooter. I have more fear that you're going to shoot me by accident or in anger or wind up shooting somebody in your family or shooting yourself. One of the things that Chris Hayes mentioned was about the tweets that happened after the shooting at the Navy Yard, about that it within seconds, the gun nuts began saying, if everybody would have had one of these, not a word of compassion, not a word of sympathy, not a word of distress, all just about, we could have stopped him. And I think the big end of his talk were saying that loaded weapons are banned at gun shows. They are gun-free zones. So given the argument that if you're in a gun-free zone, and there's very few of them, Starbucks has asked people not to bring their guns in, you know, publicly showing them in holsters and what have you. They're not going to refuse you service. They're not even going to have a sign. What if you don't know? I mean, you know if you're listening. But it's very possible that people couldn't even hear about this. But why in the world would you want to walk around and intimidate people? Because you know you're intimidating people, don't you? You know you make people feel uncomfortable. You know you frighten people. And why do you do that? Why in the world would you do that to people? You don't frighten me, but I don't want to be anywhere near you. I wonder what is going through your brain and what are you capable of? And what's going to happen if somebody came in there? Say there was an armed robbery in a Starbucks, I'd be more afraid that you'd wind up shooting me and the people I'm with than the gunman. Okay. And then one of the little things there. What's wrong with this country? 56 mass shootings? On my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, there is a list of this incredible, incredible list of mass shootings. I mean, is it just that there is access, so people have these murderous weapons available and with less restrictions on it than anybody would think would make any sense, right? But you could be, you know, the calmest person in the world. You have guns for hunting and home defense and what have you, and with legitimate uses, I would say. But you increase your risk. You don't actually increase your safety. And as I said to Ron, guns don't save people. In fact, what they do is they put people more at risk. They save some people. Ultimately, though, how many people in the last 20 years have been killed illegally, murdered? Something like 1 million. Where was I going with that? You know what I'm going to do? Well, I was going to say a couple of you are ringing. Jefferson's on a call. Hold on. In the meantime, rather than going on with that, and you can certainly comment on this in our moments remaining, I just want to tell you that we're going to have Wayne Kramer from the former lead guitar for Detroit's MC5 on, and also Larry Tye, who is the author of Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. But I was just absolutely flabbergasted that the current reigning Pope, Pope Francis, has said talk less about all the stuff that seemed to work a lot of Catholics, right-wing Catholics, up and get on with some things that are more important. He said, we cannot insist only on issues related to abortion, gay marriage, and the use of contraceptive methods. And he's saying that in kind of an odd way. He's saying we cannot insist on these only these issues. He said, this is not possible. He said, I have not spoken about these things, and I was reprimanded for that, for not speaking them. When we speak about these issues, we have to talk about them in a context. The teaching of the Church, says the Pope, for that matter, is clear, and I am a son of the Church, and he said, it's not necessary to talk about these issues all the time. Blaise Bonpain, director of the Office of the Americas. Bonpain served as a Maryknoll priest in Guatemala and has written five books. He said today, Pope Francis has made an important clarification. People might have thought that no to family planning and abortion and gay rights were the key components of the Catholic faith. In other words, opposition to birth control, opposition to abortion, opposition to the gay rights, where we see Catholics lining up with the far right wing to be the main components of the Catholic faith. Bonpain goes on, before, by directing his attention to peacemaking, let me not say that so fast, by directing his attention to peacemaking and abolishing nuclear war, he has revived, that's the Pope, revived the gospel message of John the 23rd and his encyclical Peace on Earth. Our hope is that he will now denounce the imperial theology of the just war theory, which gave us the so-called just crusades, the just inquisition, and the just conquistadores. All right, let's go back to your calls. We got those up here. Let's see, here is Drew. Drew is in Michigan. Well, so are most of us. Drew, how are you? You're on the air.
How are you doing?
Good.
I was listening to the conversation, some of it kind of striking a little bit of interest, and I noticed how you said that people wearing guns in public, it's an intimidation factor that you don't want to see it personally. And it kind of brought to mind the idea of animals in nature. Animals in nature find that certain ones have particular marks or colorings that warn other animals to stay away from it. Wouldn't you rather be informed that someone has a weapon on them rather than not know and be taken by surprise?
Well, no, because I assume that there's people around us that have concealed weapons legally. Maybe, who knows, how many have them illegally. But, you know, sometimes you're sitting there. Even, you know, I go to meetings like with police officers, and I'm thinking, geez, they got this 9mm, 14-shot Glock on their hip. And I'm comfortable with that. Largely, but, and I don't think he or she's going to go berserk on our block club meeting and start, you know, popping everybody. In fact, I would say that it probably have greater chance of the meeting being hit by a meteor than that occurring. And, but what the point is that, what's the purpose? Why would anybody do that knowing how uncomfortable they make people feel?
Well, I mean, it comes down to the idea of, like, gay rights marches.
Yeah.
I can appreciate that. I can respect that. They're marching and they're holding banners for their cause.
Right.
With a lot of the talk about weapon bans and guns being taken away, as far-fetched as that is, some people feel the need that they too should march for their cause.
Well, I got that. But, you know, you're right. There's not really talk about gun bans. Somebody that had the two senators that had the temerity to suggest that maybe they ought to have background checks on people that want to buy guns in Colorado after what happened at Aurora, what happened, at that high school a few years ago and all of that, Columbine, that maybe there ought to be a little look at people's background and they could weed out, as they've done, a couple of million people so you don't look. I mean, that kid that shot up, the elementary school in Connecticut, he just got his mom's gun. So that didn't stop that. That's for sure. But the something as simple as being able to background check and for instance, this recent shooter at Navy Yard, if they would have had if he tried to get a gun, they said you had to, you know, go through a background check, which wasn't immediate. And he would probably, or I don't know whether he had slipped through the cracks or not, because he had had a number of contacts with mental health professionals. But I don't know. A lot of this we go around and around about. All right, Drew, thank you very much. Let me get Mike from Clyde. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Oh, just a couple of things. I'm kind of more in the middle on it. I think that some things need to be tightened, but I'm not for gun control like you are. You know, a couple things.
Wait. Like, how do you know what I'm for?
Because the way you talk.
Well, you're inferring.
You should be right or wrong.
Well, I wouldn't say that background checks is gun control, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it is. Maybe it has some control. Do you think there should be no controls on the possession of guns?
No, I don't. That's why I'm saying I'm not either extreme on it.
Well, I don't know. I think extreme would be the desire to confiscate all 300 million guns that we have in this country, and that's not
right there.
I mean, listen, having gun registration background checks is not going to stop these mass murders. There's an insane thread going through this whole culture that these men act out their rage and their insanity by targeting any number, schools or movie theater patrons or what have you. And there's no way in the world that background checks are going to stop that. But who knows? I mean, Ron was talking about that the murder rate has decreased. There's also been at least 1 million people have been denied the ability to buy guns because of background checks. And why people wouldn't want universal background checks is way beyond me. What about you?
I don't really think that when you're saying universal, I'd rather see it require training instead of, I mean, background checks to a point until they fix the system isn't going to work because, and that's another thing I don't know. I heard on the news that they said that he had done a background check to get the shotgun, but there was nothing in his record to stop him,
even though
there was minor incidents.
He couldn't get the semi-automatic that he wanted. All right, well, okay, so let's train everybody. So do you think that is actually going to stop mass murders?
I don't think anything will stop them.
Yeah, you know what? That's what President Obama said yesterday or today, or today is Monday already, yesterday or the day before, or I think it was on Sunday, at this memorial for the Navy Yard victims. He said he refuses to accept this as the new normal. You do.
I don't accept it. I don't think it can be stopped. I think there's some that can be stopped. I think it can be slowed down, but I don't think that you can ever totally stop it.
Well, isn't that accepting it? How can you slow it down? How do you slow it down? I don't know. How can you stop these people from committing these mad acts?
Like I said, I'm not with what they say, good people with guns, but it's got to be people that are trained, that are out there, that have them, hopefully trained better than New York cops. They're only shooting 34%.
Well, you know what? I don't think with all, and I mean this, usually when you start a sentence like this, you mean you're going to insult somebody. With all due respect to all police officers, it's when you're in a situation like that, no matter how trained you are, no matter how much time you spend on the gun range, no matter how many times you have workshops about what to do when you're confronted with a shooter, the adrenaline, the confusion is just manifest. And oftentimes when there's been these cases in New York, when one police officer starts shooting, they all start shooting, and there's been any number of cases where unarmed civilians have been hit 30 and 40 times. In Miami, the Miami cops just shot some guy, I can't remember how many totaled, I mean, it was dozens and dozens of shots. Partly it has to do with the weaponry and the capacity to empty these magazines quickly in these 9mm. So I don't think training, you can't get better trained than a New York City police officer. And you're talking about the local guy down the block that when he's in a movie theater and he sees a muzzle flash and he shoots, and then the person across the way from him who's armed sees a muzzle flash and shoots back at them. That's what the guy said on the tape. You're going to have how many people are shooting?
Oh, in a dark area, you shouldn't shoot, period.
Yeah, but then you got somebody shooting though. I don't know what to do, and universal background checks are fine with me. I don't think they're going to stop mass murders. I agree with you, Mike. But what are we going to do to have a sense of security? I mean, was it you or the guy before? We were talking about, it was the guy before, but someone walking into a place with a open carry. Do you have children by any chance?
They're older, but with the open carry, I understand the right and everything, but to me, if I was going to do something crazy and I walked into a place, the first people I shoot is the ones with the guns on their hip.
Well, there you go. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. You know, I was going to go on, and I don't know. I'm just looking at the clock. Got a few minutes left. Then we're going to do our interviews. But, you know, it's very fashionable, and I think I actually create this impression as well, that there is no difference between the two political parties. Although some of you, I think, get the impression that that Jalene and I are these Democratic Party partisans, that we are, you know, Democratic Party liberals. When someone calls us a liberal, we always say, oh, we're more radical than that, pardon, which is, I don't know, true, I guess, but probably in a way would take too long to, you know, to explain. But both parties ultimately are beholden to Wall Street, without a doubt. I mean, that's where a lot of their finance money comes from. They believe, as has been said, the business of the United States is business, so they do whatever they can to benefit large corporations, financial institutions, and what have you, and put as little regulations on them as possible. The Republicans don't want to put any on them. They're perfectly okay with the, you know, the big companies and the big financial interests looting the average person, you know, without a doubt. They want less regulations. They want more pollution. They want to allow more pollution. Anything that would stop the accumulation of profits for companies, no matter what it's doing, whether, you know, it's befouling the air or threatening our economy. I mean, they've learned nothing from the fiasco of Reaganomics and its culmination in the Bush recession of 2007. Because of a lot of reasons, the Obama administration has not been able, mostly because of the obstruction of the Republicans who defend Wall Street, who defend the big corporations without, you know, without any hesitation. They haven't really done the kind of regulations that need to be done. The financial institutions have to be so tightly regulated that they can't squeak without an administrator looking over their shoulder. Oh, that'll inhibit profits. That'll do that. They're making so many profit. There's so much profits as they is. What they need to do is make less profits, and more of that money has to go to the middle class, the working class, and the poor for sure. Now, you also get things like the administration is going ahead with limiting carbon emissions for nations power companies when they're first starting up. And what they want to do, if you're ready for this, that they limit new gas-fired power plants to 1,000 pounds of carbon dioxide emissions per megawatt hour and new coal plants to 1,100 pounds of carbon dioxide. Now, this is still absolutely polluting our environment, creating global warming, threatening future generations, and instead, you know, Obama and his administration take on this very, very limited approach to it. But the coal industry has just gone crazy, and the coal lobby in the American Energy Alliance, which is financed by guess who? The Koch brothers, K-O-C-H. If you don't know who the Koch brothers are, it would really do you well to just Google them, K-O-C-H brothers, and see what these guys are into. These are these billionaires, multi-billionaires, two of the top 10 richest people in the country, and they still demand to do everything possible to increase their profits, increase their wealth, and do it to the detriment of our environment and us and our health. They are mad. They are truly mad. They could use their billions to create a clean planet. They could have coal-fired plants with zero emissions. Or if they couldn't, maybe they ought to get into some alternative energy. Anyway, that's it for me. Jefferson, thank you very much for taking the calls. Jalene, you get better. I'm sure she'll be back next week, a little under the weather today. Stay tuned for a couple of great interviews. The first one up with Wayne Kramer, a former lead guitar of Detroit's MC5.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Jeez, Q, it's hot as in here. What's going on?
Oh, it's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Shh. Ouch! The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet?
No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
Mm-mm, no.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
What's your name?
Dale.
Hi, Dale. You're going to Vegas.
Are you kidding me?
No.
No. WRIF Sin City Takeover 2013. Learn more and sign up for your totally unfair Rift Cyber Crew advantage now at WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you, and it's a pleasure to welcome a Detroiter back home, someone who has made a mark in the rock and roll world for several decades now. It's Wayne Kramer, and I'm sure most of you know he began his career with as the lead guitar of the MC5. In fact, Rolling Stone said he's one of the top 100 guitarists of all times in rock and roll, and his career since then has been absolutely amazing. We'll get to a lot of that, but right now, as they used to say, Brother Wayne Kramer, welcome home.
Thanks, Peter. Happy to be here.
Well, you've been a busy lad since those grandy days of the 1960s. In fact, the MC5 was the first, it played at the opening of the Grandy Ballroom and the closing night as well.
We bookended it.
We saw that in the film. Have you seen the Grandy Ballroom film?
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
No.
Well, it was absolutely great, and talk about bringing back memories. But, you know, I think I'd actually begin with a question is, when you've had a career that spans the 1960s through the new millennium, and people are still saying, yeah, kick out the jams, do you want to say, look, that was a long time ago, I'm doing all of this right now, I've done all this, I've done this HBO music, you know, score writing and all that, or are they equally important?
Well, I mean, Kick Out the Jams is an eternal expression. I mean, it's fresh every time you use it, and it's always in right now. Right now is the only time you can kick out the jams. You can't kick out the jams yesterday or tomorrow. You can only kick out the jams right now. So it all, you know, it's always good, and you know, it's a song that I wrote, and me and Rob Tyner sat at the kitchen table and wrote that song, and it's a ball to play it. I still play it almost every time I play out. I do the tune, and it always works. The crowd always goes crazy when we play it, and I think it's just one of those, you know, I guess we call it an evergreen.
Sure. Well, we play it on our HD station here, and of course we do not play those famous, it's, you know, Kick Out the Jams, MF. And that got you guys in a lot of trouble when you would play it at clubs all around town. They would just wait for Rob Tyner, the lead singer of the MC5, to say, all right, time two. And there'd be this big pause and then Kick Out the Jams, MF. And then boom, bam, boom, you guys would all wind up in police cars.
Yeah, it's imagine it's impossible for anyone that isn't our age to remember or to know what that was like, you know, that you could actually be arrested for using words that everybody uses every day, you know, and effectively got the MC5 kicked out of the record business, you know.
How
but,
so?
But there's, well, yeah, let me tell you that. But since we're on the subject of Kick Out the Jams, you know, there's been a number of bands that have covered the song over the years. Henry Rollins and the Bad Brains did a terrific version of
it.
I love Rage Against the Machine's version of it. But my favorite version of Kick Out the Jams is by an Australian band called Deep Street Soul.
Wow.
If you hear it, you'll find out the truth of the MC5.
Wayne Kramer, former lead guitar of the MC5, and now with 10 solo albums under his belt, and a lot of work about social justice and prison reform, which we'll get to in just a little while. But we were talking before this how the system previously was so rigid, but now is able to accommodate any hairstyle, any music, any rude language, and so... But now you when you say kick out the jams, MF, it's almost just like a nostalgia point.
I hate this. Takes us back to the thrilling days of yesteryear. Yeah, I think that in some ways America has grown up. You know, in many other ways, maybe more important ways, it hasn't. But in some ways, the idea of language on the airways, you know, with satellite radio and cable television. That you can portray things in a more realistic manner. We don't have to have the Victorian, you know, 50s censorship hanging over our heads all the time. And it, believe me, it makes for better art.
You know, I was just thinking about how many times when you're reading the music press that the MC5 is referred to. And you know, a seminal rock band, a seminal punk band, stage theatrics that set the style and the pace. When you guys were doing that, you couldn't have possibly had any thought that you were actually making history. Did you realize that you were a cut above everything else that was going on?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. In fact, we used to discuss was something that we're doing historically valid.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, Rob, it was some the big concern of Rob Tyner's. You know, he was just a genius artist. And a lot of times, you know, we would be talking about doing, you know, a song and a musical arrangement or maybe some performance concept that we were trying to work on. And the subject would come up when we, you know, we'd have to kick that back and forth. Is this going to hold up? You know, what's this going to be like in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? Or, you know, is this so timely that it won't be meaningful 10 years from now or 20 years from now? It was actually something we talked about.
Now, your bandmates, Rob Tyner and Fred Sonic Smith and Michael Davis, have all passed away, all at very young ages. So that must have a hole in your heart, certainly a hole in our musical heritage, to be sure, because those guys would still be playing. Michael playing right up to his death.
We played a concert together last summer in France in DKT MC5, and I knew then that Michael was very, very ill. He couldn't stand to play. He had to play the gig sitting down. And it wasn't as though his death was unexpected. You know, we knew he was very ill. You know, Rob and Fred's deaths were just it's very hard to, you know, to describe, really, because, you know, we grew up together. We were schoolboys.
Lincoln Park.
Yeah, and downriver there. And and we went through so much together. And then one day. They're not here anymore. They're not in the world anymore. And recently, with Michael leaving too, it just reminds me that time is finite, you know, and life is finite. And if you're gonna do anything, if you're gonna, you know, accomplish anything, you only get so much time. You know, time is the most valuable thing I have.
Sure. Wayne Kramer, formerly the MC5, solo artist in his own right, and we're going to talk in a little while about all the music he's done for HBO and PBS and what have you. Also, his project called Jail Guitar Doors USA that he's done with British singer-songwriter Billy Bragg, who's been on this show any number of times. You listen to the Peter Werby Show. Well, I've often, in fact, as you may have heard, Farouk Z. Bey, a staple of Detroit jazz, passed away recently. And it occurred to me that many ways you often, as a, you can have your choice of being a musician or live to 94. Yet you look just healthy as all get out, and you know, it's. But it's not a ticket for being a musician. Is not a ticket for a long life, is it?
High attrition rate in this game.
Yeah.
Because you know, it's an unorthodox life. It has a great. Benefits, great fringe benefits, and you get to do things that you wouldn't normally think are possible. But You know, having come up, through the 60s, we all experimented with drugs. Everybody, I didn't know anyone that didn't take
experiment.
Some kind of drug.
I always say, and it was successful.
Yeah.
A successful experiment.
It was. But some of us, a small percentage of us, cross over into active addiction and alcoholism. And these are fatal. These are fatal disorders if left untreated.
But that happened to you in a big, very serious way.
I am a sober alcoholic. Yeah. I'm a clean drug addict, and I was out there for a long time. It was a way, a coping mechanism for me.
Self-medicating.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I fell into recovery. I stumbled and tripped and fell into recovery, and I found a way to live where drinking and drugs aren't necessary. And I end up, kind of figuring out what's important and what isn't important. I'm very fortunate.
And this kind of leads us into Jail Guitar Doors USA, one of your projects, besides all the great music that you do. You wound up on the wrong side of bars, right?
Well, I did. After the band broke up, I really lost my way. I had my whole life was invested in the MC5. I was the band leader. I got the guys together. And I had really achieved all my ambitions and goals by the time I was 19 years old. Here I was. I was in a hugely popular band here in Detroit.
The MC5,
we could draw 2,000 or 3,000 kids to a performance at the Grandy. I could make a living as a professional musician. I was getting all the sex I could handle. And that was considerable in those days.
Including under the stage. I'm not giving anything away. Never mind. But that's in the movie. That's in the Grandy Ballroom movie. I'm not talking out of school.
And I was part of a community. I had great friends and comrades, and we were living through exciting and dangerous times. And then one day it all went away. The truth is that at least what I know now looking back on is the center never holds. And the way things are today, they won't be like this 5 years from now. And one day I didn't have the band anymore didn't have my way to make money and didn't have my friends and didn't have my community and my support system. And I really lost it. Talent isn't enough. Talent, knowing how to play the guitar or write a song or dance on stage isn't enough. And when times got tough, I started slipping down, and my drug use and my alcoholism really took over. And I fell into a way of life that was kind of a backwards, a bizarro way of life, where what used to be good was considered bad and what used to be considered bad was now good. Mm. Like if you did wrong, you were admired for that,
You're a rebel.
Yeah. And I went all the way with it. And I ended up with a 4-year federal prison term, thanks to the Honorable Judge Robert J. DiMasio in federal court in downtown Detroit.
And you served what? Just a little over 2 years?
I did 2.5 on it.
Yeah. Yeah. That must have been literally a sobering experience.
Well, it was and it wasn't. I mean, they give you time to think.
Yeah.
And had a long time to contemplate how I got there and what I could do to not come back. And fortunately, I never did go back, unlike most people that go to prison. But I learned some things about myself and about addiction and recovery, but the state of the art wasn't as finely tuned as it is today. And I still came out and continued to drink and drug for many years afterwards. It took me a long time to finally hit that bottom.
Wayne Kramer is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Wayne Kramer, singer-songwriter. He's got 10 solo albums, and I don't want to let him leave without talking about all the film and documentary and work he's done scoring these great television shows as well, and also his project, Jail Guitar Doors USA. When you came out of prison, I know you, for a while, hooked up with Johnny Thunder. And I remember I saw you guys at the old Miami bar on Cass, and the sound that was coming out of your amplifiers, I had myself pinned behind this little alcove, or I thought I would have started bleeding from the ears.
Good. That was our intention.
All right. So, but let's jump, because this is part of what this is all about, is why you had just come from Washington, D.C. and talking to some United States senators, which is a long way from some of the other stuff we were talking about.
It's a long way from the Grandy Ballroom.
Yes. Right? Tell us about Jail Guitar Doors USA and what that's all about.
Well, while I was in prison, this new music movement emerged called punk rock. And there was a band in England called The Clash.
Sure. Great.
Who were great admirers of the MC5. And when they heard I went to prison, they wrote a song about me and a couple other guys having trouble with the authorities. And the song was called Jail Guitar Doors.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And so when I got out, I went down, they came to Detroit to play, and I went over to see them and thank them. And I thought it was like, a show of solidarity. My British brothers, musicians, reaching out to another musician. And I didn't think much of it until about 3 years ago. I had put together a group of musicians, Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, Perry Farrell and his wife Etty, Jerry Cantrell from Alice in Chains, Gilby Clark from Guns N' Roses, Handsome Dick Manitoba, Don Was.
Yeah.
And one of the guys I asked to come with me was Billy Bragg. I'd known Billy. You see him around. We all run into each other in our working life. And Billy had Jail Guitar Doors written on his guitar. And I said, that's interesting, Bill. And he said, oh, yeah, it's an old Clash B-side. Have you ever heard it?
Yeah,
and I said, hey, Bill, the song is about me. And he said, oh, blimey, I forgot. It is about you, isn't it? And he tells me the story that he started an independent initiative in England because a man had called him who worked in a prison who was trying to use music as rehabilitation with addicts, but they didn't have any guitars. And could Billy find him some guitars? And he saw it as a way to honor the life of Joe Strummer. And he called it Jail Guitar Doors, named after the Clash song. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just started the wheels turning in my little damaged brain okay, Bill, you're in England, and this is a good thing you're doing, but I'm an American, and, you know, I am an ex-prisoner, and I'm in music here, and maybe I should take this on for myself. Because really, It's the antidote for my alcoholism and my drug addiction. You know, one thing we learn when we start to go inward to find out what the hell's wrong with us as alcoholics and addicts is we're incredibly selfish. I am selfish and self-centered and self-seeking to my core. It's the core source of my problem. Is, you know, you can come first right after me.
But it also is, and this is not unusual for creative people, it also is what drives creativity frequently, always.
Absolutely, yeah. But, of course, like most things, I go too far with it because I'm an extremist.
Yeah, okay.
And so the antidote for that is to be of service to my fellows, you know, to be a worker amongst workers, to be a fellow amongst fellows, no better, no worse. And to do something for somebody else, to go out of my way to do something for somebody else. And so it all fit together for me that, you know, Jail Guitar Doors, you know, I have 1 foot in prison. I have 1 foot in music. I could be a bridge. I have a great community around me of other musicians. JGD is a musician founded, musician operated nonprofit charity. And, so we took it on. Me and Billy and my wife Margaret formed JGD USA, and so we're going into our third year now. And what we do is simple. We find people that work in corrections that are willing to use music as rehabilitation, and we provide them with guitars. So far we've been in over a dozen prisons, California, Arizona, Nevada, Texas, New York.
And you're welcomed by the prison authorities. I think this is a good idea.
Most of them.
We're
having some trouble getting into the federal prisons.
Oh.
The federals seem to have a little harsher line that they draw. But the states are so broke and so overcrowded with prisoners. There's no money for programs anymore. There is no rehabilitation in prison in America today. And so when they hear that we can help them, that we can provide them with musical instruments, they're thrilled to see us coming. And sometimes we produce live concert events in prison. We have one we're scheduled to do next month at Lancaster in the California Department of Corrections, which is the largest maximum security facility in the state.
You play the old Johnny Cash song? That would be appropriate.
No.
I killed a man, and they all go, yeah!
Yeah, yeah. No, this is, we play everything. You know, we play Jailbreak.
Really?
We play fun. Wish You Were Here. Yeah, we play, it's amazing the stuff we get away with.
If you'd like to hook on to this and find out more about it, it's jailguitardoors.org. Jailguitardoors.org. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com as well. Wayne Kramer is my guest, songwriter and a guitar player who Rolling Stone designated as one of the top 100 guitarists of all times. And I want to get back to that, but real quickly, I promised I would tell people also about all the scoring you had done for film and television. I didn't, you know, I got to tell you, I didn't even know you were doing all that. And you got a host of credits to, you know, you have a host of credits. Yeah.
Well, I've been very fortunate. You know, I moved to Los Angeles in 94 with an eye towards film and TV work. You know, I'd been getting in the van for a long time, and I really enjoyed it in my 30s and in my 40s and even into my 50s. I'm 64 now, and I still love to play live. I play live often. I play live a lot. I still go on tour in the summer. In fact, last summer I was on tour all year with all summer with Marianne Faithfull.
Oh. Great,
the wonderful Marianne Faithfull.
Oh, wow.
As her.
And you did duets?
No, I just was a member of the band.
Okay, all right.
But, you know, scoring is, it was a chance for me to get into something new that I always felt, you know, I could plug into that. I thought I could do that. And, I get a chance to be the new guy again, you know, and there's a whole learning curve to scoring to picture. And it's not for most musicians. Most musicians are not cut out for it because it's not your music anymore. It's the director's music. And you're not the deal. You're not the focus of attention anymore. The story is the focus. So I've been fortunate. I scored three seasons of Eastbound and Down for HBO. I've done a half dozen or so feature films. I've got a couple more that I'm looking at now, and I've been able to keep working and learning, really. I've gone back to school, you know.
Sure.
My history in rock and roll didn't actually prepare me for where do you put the French horns and the violins, you know.
You know, oftentimes, Wayne Kramer, when I am interviewing people and I see, like we have now about 3.5 minutes, I'm usually interviewing authors and I'm saying, yeah, well, there's so much more to talk about, but that's why this man has written a book. Wayne Kramer, MC5, your prisons, film, everything. You got to crank out a memoir, my friend.
Actually, I have been. I've got probably 80 or 90,000 words written, and I'm trying to get it down because I just feel like I got to set the record straight, you know, at least tell the story from my perspective. You know, I talk to so many writers and journalists, and, you know, they get paid for telling my story. And I said, well, hell, why shouldn't I get paid for telling my story?
Real quickly, because Wayne Kramer, you were invited to, and you're going to speak today, to the Association of Alternative Newspapers, which includes Detroit's Metro Times. Are you going to be talking about prison reform? Is that what, or?
Well, arts and activism.
Okay.
You know, how is it that some artists connect with efforts out bigger than their career, you know, and try to use the platform that we have. Guys like Peter Werbe invite you over to their radio show, and you get a chance to talk on the air, to talk about something that might actually make a difference, you know. And I think what I'm trying to do is get this conversation started out in the world about mass incarceration in America. You know, we are in the middle of the greatest failure of social policy in America's domestic history. We have over 2.5 million of our neighbors locked up in prison. We lock up people in America 5 times the rate of the rest of the world. Either we're the most evil people in the history of the world, or we're doing something terribly wrong about locking people up.
As you know, it's called the prison industrial complex, and we need to produce clients for that huge economic apparatus.
Yeah, and it was a surefire vote getter. There was great political expediency. You know, nobody ever lost an election being tough on crime. And even as crime has been going down over the last two decades, they've been building more and more prisons and sentencing people to more and more severe sentences, longer and longer periods of time. And what's happened is it's reached a tipping point where it's now unsustainable. That in California, for example, we spend more on prisoners than we do on higher education.
Wow.
The states are broke. They can't afford to lock this many people up. And the end result is, you know, 90% of the people that go to prison are coming out one day, and they're going to live next door to you and me. And if you've been locked up for decades and inculcated in a world of violence, racism, bitterness, and defeat, and they plop you back out on the street, you're not only not better, you're worse.
But wait,
we're less safe.
Yeah. I want to thank you, Wayne Kramer, and I can see this, what has been called this arc of justice, beginning with the beginning of the MC5 in the 1960s and right up to your art and activism today. You can go to jailguitardoors.org. Also, waynekramer.com is a good place to check out as well. And you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Brother Wayne Kramer, welcome home.
Thank you, Brother Peter Werbe. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be with you. Happy to be within earshot of all my mainline mellows out there.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Business owners and professionals face special challenges in divorce court. In addition to everything else going on, they have to contend with allegations that they are earning more than they are, coupled with claims on their business or practices themselves.
Attorney, CPA, Joe Cordell.
An effective defense often hinges on subtle and sophisticated strategies, on things such as business valuations, income allocations, and tax income projections. Clients with assets depend on their divorce lawyer's skills in these matters, and that's why it's so important to hire someone that has those skills.
The domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell is the partner men can count on, particularly in the face of complex litigation. Cordell & Cordell, offering sophisticated solutions for men in divorce. 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor. 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Well, it's up, up and away times, folks. That means Superman, right? It's a cultural icon, the man of steel, the truth, justice in the American way. I mean, that's just almost become a cliche. And most of us know the story, or do we? I'm willing to bet probably, since Superman has faded a little bit, although it's a comeback in the works, that the story of Superman probably isn't riveted in your mind. Certainly not the backstory of Superman. It's incredible. Joining me is Larry Tye. He's been on this broadcast any number of times. He has a new book about Superman. And previously, previously, I've interviewed him about, in fact, one of my favorite interviews that I've played a couple of times, Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. That's Satchel Paige, the great African-American fastball pitcher. Also, there's another excellent book called Rising from the Rails about the porters on the guys on the railroads. There was just an incredible story of civil rights as well. And also with Kitty Dukakis, he wrote the book called Shock. And now the new one is Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Larry Tye in his office in Lexington, Massachusetts. So it's up, up, and away. Larry Tye, welcome back.
Great to be back with you, Peter.
Well, the obvious thing is, why is there so much about Superman? The comics are real thin little things and all that, but you've got this big book. You've interviewed 300 people. You've gone through all these magazine articles. You've watched television series and movies. What beguiled you about the Superman story?
So there's a serious part of what interested me and drew me to this story, and the serious part is I'm really intrigued about heroes and why Americans embrace the heroes that they do. That was what drew me to Satchel Paige. It's what's drawn me to my next book, which is a biography of Robert Kennedy, and I decided that the best way to understand America and its heroes was to look at the longest lasting hero of the last century. And that wasn't a politician and it wasn't a sports figure. It was, or at least I argue in this Superman book, that it was Superman who was brought to life 74 years ago and looks like he'll last another century. And that was a serious side. It was a lens into America and what our heroes tell us about us. The fun side of it was I wanted to be 10 years old again, and no better way to be 10 than to go back and play with Superman.
Well, as I said, there's two stories really here. I didn't say there's two stories. I said there's a backstory. But the first story is the story of Superman himself and how he arrives on Earth and his exploits and all that. And the other is the creators. Give us just a quick reminder about Superman. And I'd be surprised how many people, I guess they know, everybody knows he came from kryptonite because the planet was dying. And I'm not even sure I remember what they sent him off as. His father was, I am forgetting. What was his father's name? Jor-El, was it?
His father's name changed over the years, and his father's name on Krypton was Jor-El, and he came to this planet. Jor-El was a brilliant scientist on Krypton who understood that the planet was about to explode. And instead of rescuing everybody from the planet, all the elders thought that this guy was a nut, and they just didn't believe him. So right before the planet explodes, he has a small spacecraft that can basically fit his baby son, and he sends the infant son off towards planet Earth, which he thinks has an environment similar enough to Krypton that the baby will survive. No idea what's going to happen. He sends the baby off in a rocket ship. The planet explodes, and Jor-El and his wife go with him. And suddenly, a year or two later, this baby is now an infant who has come to Earth and shows up in the heartland, not far from where you are there in Detroit, and is discovered by a passing motorist named Kent. And they take the baby, they adopt him as their own, and thus begins the life of Clark Kent and Superman.
Huh. And he was created by a couple of urbanites, but yet set in the Midwest. Tell us a little about the creators.
The creators were intriguing to me because they're the story of Superman as he's played out repeatedly over the last 75 years. They were two Jewish teenagers in Cleveland, Ohio, in the middle of the Great Depression. One of them, a guy named Jerry Siegel, had just lost his dad during a robbery at his dad's haberdashery store. Jerry is the sixth of six kids of this Lithuanian immigrant, and he's lost not just his dad, but his mentor and his hero. So this is a young man looking for a hero at a time when America is in a crisis and it needs a hero. And I don't think in the history of American publishing there's been better timing with the launch of a new book than the idea of Superman in the middle of the Depression, on the eve of World War II, when America needed not just a hero, but a strong man who would give them a sense of their own strength.
Do you think the two creators were aware, since they were teenagers, oftentimes teenagers aren't too aware of world events, some are, that what they were immersed in, I mean, the fact that the Superman character was strong and could had superpowers in an era when everything was so unsure?
I think it was partly a question of their personal circumstances. As I said, Jerry had lost his dad. His artist buddy, Joe Shuster, had a family that was down and out, and they wanted to live in a world that was better than their world, and creating their own fantasy world is what kids do generally. So it was partly a matter of these kids having been creative and come up with a fantasy that worked for them. And the idea that it worked at that moment in history so well for America, I think was largely a matter of luck. They did have a sense that the country was a bit down and out, but giving them sort of a global feeling of what was going on in the outside world is much more than I think they would have even claimed credit for. They just knew that they needed a hero, and the fact that their hero played so well for the country and eventually the world was just, as I say, a matter of serendipity and of their being creative.
It's interesting, the name, Superman. We, of course, have, when anyone says Superman, one either imagines the cartoon figure or, in popular culture, it's someone who has great powers or, you know, boy, that's a Superman of football, or even you hear it used in any number of different ways. Yet in Nietzsche's, the German philosopher, his Übermensch translates pretty loosely into Superman. Could those Jewish kids have been aware that that of this connection and the fact that the Nazis were actually mistakenly attaching themselves to Nietzsche's philosophy?
I think that they probably wouldn't have been aware of it generally anyway, but the fact is that they invented their character, and it took them a couple years to sell it. And my sense is that the chance of their having been aware at an even earlier era than when Superman was published, that their character had any connection to what Nietzsche was doing and to what the Germans were doing in either adopting or perverting, as some people say, the Nietzschean vision of this Übermensch, I think is a stretch. Their Superman also started out initially as S-U-P-E-R hyphen, capital M-A-N, and it started out as a bad guy, not as a heroic figure. And over time, they dropped the hyphen, and they added the sense of nobility. And I think that they understood, they were smart enough to know that a good guy was an easier sell to a country that they wanted to sell comic books or comic strips to than an evil hero. We had plenty of evil heroes in the world then, evil figures, and they wanted somebody that people could see as a source of light and of righteousness.
Yet, Larry Tai, you think Superman was Jewish?
I do think he was Jewish.
We're talking Krypton, the planet Krypton, to Kansas. There's the number of Jews in Kansas in the 1930s you could probably count on one hand. What? How could he be Jewish?
I think that's a great point. And the reason I think he's Jewish, the evidence for it, is partly the name that he came from Krypton with. It was Kal-El, which in Hebrew means a vessel of God. And it was, I think, the story of Exodus. The parents send off their son, who they're afraid will be killed, and sort of float him out. Instead of on the Nile River, they're floating him out in the air. He's adopted by a Gentile couple in the middle of Kansas, which is precisely what happened to Moses when he was found by the Pharaoh's daughter in Egypt. And the destruction of the planet is straight out of Genesis. The saving of the little baby is straight out of Exodus, and there are sort of five or six other little hints that I think that were not accidental that these two Jewish kids threw in there. To me, the most fun of those is the fact that any name that ends in man, whether it's Silberman or any name that ends in man, is either a superhero or Jewish. But the fact that I think he was Jewish hasn't stopped Christians from adopting him as the perfect Christ story. God sends his, son to earth to save mankind. Buddhists see it as a perfect Zen story. And atheists see Superman as the ultimate secular hero. So I think we love this hero enough that we each call him our own.
The book is Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Larry Tye, T-Y-E, is my guest. And you can go to LarryTye.com, and it'll be there, plus all of his other wonderful books that we've interviewed him about in the past. Now, let's get a little back to the origins of the introduction of Superman to the American public. How did these two young kids sell this comic strip, this comic book to, I'm forgetting, was it Marvel or it was DC, right? Yeah, DC.
It was DC. Yeah,
yeah.
It was, they did it with great patience and great anxiety. They would send it off. They initially envisioned it not as a comic book, but as a comic strip, and that was the big deal in those days. Newspapers were running comic strips. Comic books were a whole new enterprise. They sent it off to every publisher they could, and they'd sometimes get nice responses saying no. Sometimes they'd get no response at all, and it took them a couple years of fine-tuning the character and persisting with this, and finally they found these people who were about to start DC Comics and were looking for a bunch of stories. The people who published the first Superman had no idea it was going to be a success. The kids had no idea, Jerry and Joe, that it was going to work. And what happened was that it was on the cover on some issues, and some issues it went inside. And they started noticing that every time Superman was on the cover, that the comic book would sell off the stands immediately, and they'd have to order tens of thousands of new copies. And it was as instantaneous a success as you ever find in a field of sort of pop culture like that. He just took off in a way that tapped a nerve that nobody, not the publisher, and not the writers or the artist had ever envisioned.
Now, there was a Superman number one comic, right?
There was indeed, and that was with him on the cover.
And how much did that sell for? Was it 10 cents?
That was under 10 cents in those days. I think the first one was about 8 cents, and it was an experiment. I mean, it cost them almost nothing to produce it, and it was an outgrowth of what they used to call the pulp fiction, these sort of romantic or even pornographic stories that would sell. They called it penny pulp fiction because they would actually sometimes sell for just a penny. Hmm. And those took off in a way that was such that they decided that a more explicit kids' audience with more heroic stories might work. And Superman, it was on Superman's muscle-bound back that not just the idea of these superheroes took off, but the idea of the comic book itself.
Now, so under 10 cents, if I wanted to go buy that number one now, how much would it cost me?
Well, right now, if you had a mint condition Superman Action Comics number one, you could get easily $1 million for it.
That's all. Pardon me, that always strikes me as so absolutely incredible. Larry Tye is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book is Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. It's published by Random House, and I think this is, like so many of Larry's other books, is going to be flying off the shelves, speaking about flying. Were there superheroes before Superman that flew and had incredible powers and all? I mean, I know there were heroes, but were they like Superman, or was this the first?
There were heroes like Superman and ones that he actually borrowed from. There was a character named Doc Savage. There was a character named Hugo Danner who was written up in a great book called The Gladiator. There were a number of heroes that he borrowed from. He also explicitly borrowed from Samson and from the Greek heroes like Hercules. But there was none that quite combined the powers that Superman did and quite tapped into this idea of the alter ego of Clark Kent.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, as we see in the heroes that came before and that came after, if a hero had a disguise, the disguise was generally who the real character was, and the hero was what they dressed up as to sort of disguise who they were. In the case of Superman, what was unique, and I think what made it special, was that the real character was the hero, was Superman who disguised himself as Clark Kent rather than the other way around. And what it really was Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster and every kid in America in that era. Now, the schlubbier you looked, and the more likely that you were wearing spectacles and that you were a little bit short and a little bit round, the more you were convinced that if people could only see inside you, they'd see there was a superhero buried in there. And that's what I think Jerry Siegel was doing in creating Superman and Clark Kent.
You know, when we talk about his disguise, you think, well, let me see, he had glasses and a suit on, and then he you know, changes into this bodysuit. And in your book, Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, there's great, cartoons and photographs. And at one point, and this is interesting, this has, I think, a lot to do with the way things have changed. In a comic from 1966, Superman is burst into this door, and he says, "I'll tell you why I'll never marry you, Lana, or you, Lois. Who wants a wife so stupid she doesn't realize I'm Superman when I take off my Clark Kent glasses?" That's absolutely incredible.
That is incredible, and that's a wonderful sort of part of the game of the whole Superman Clark Kent thing was that on TV, in the movies, and even in the comic books, they look so alike that just everybody was saying, you know, how could you be that stupid? And that part of what went on, whatever medium he was in, Superman was essentially winking at the readers and saying, you know who I am, and these people, everybody wanted to play along, that they so bought into the whole idea. If you're buying into the fact that Superman can fly and that he has these incredible powers of X-ray vision and super hearing, why not buy into the fact that people were dumb enough to sort of accept his disguise? And at various times over the years, the writers tried to offer explanations that the public was hypnotized by his glasses or that there was something strange going on. But they realized these explanations were unnecessary, that we were all willing to buy into this whole story because we loved the whole righteous character that we were creating, and we wanted to have those kinds of powers ourselves. And it was our fantasy being played out as well as a morality tale.
Well, you know, Larry, it occurred to me when I saw this that how sort of postmodern that was, that, you've kind of are looking, or you're being told the magician's trick or something like that. It was pure innocence. I mean, he saved the world, and Superman did, and caught malefactors and criminals and what have you. But suddenly, you know, people kind of got wise to what was behind the scenes and had to, and the comics kind of reflected that as well. They increasingly, these comic book characters and superheroes had more and more human flaws. They weren't perfect anymore.
That's very true. And essentially the comic books and their superheroes were changing at the same time America was changing. The reason Superman has lasted for 74 years and counting is that he evolved more than the fruit fly, that essentially every era got a Superman that they could relate to. And in the first days, he was the great crusading New Deal liberal when we were in the middle of the New Deal. By the time of the Reagan Revolution, he had moved rightward, and his politics were more conservative, and his defense of the status quo as opposed to the underdog was more transparent. And every era, the change was the subtlety, the sense of them being more nuanced characters and not perfect. All of that was part of who we were. And that's the brilliant thing about Superman. Today, to kids, they see him as his hero the same way I did in the 1960s and Jerry Siegel did in the 1930s.
Well, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the original creators, so they must be, and their heirs must be multimillionaires, right?
Well, they could become multi-millionaires. The sad news is that Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster died. Jerry Siegel's wife recently died, and the heirs are getting more and more removed from them, but they're in the middle of a major lawsuit. They were trying to reclaim the rights that Jerry and Joe sold in the 1930s for $130 between the two of them.
Oh.
And these rights today will easily be worth tens of millions and could be in the hundreds of millions. And it looks like they're going to get a major award if they don't reach a settlement. And we're talking huge amounts of money here.
Now, did they continue to create Superman? And were they paid well during the 30s and 40s and 50s, all that? Did they?
They did. Through the 1940s, they were paid very well. They were paid a salary. They never had ownership of the character because they had given that away at the beginning, but they earned salaries that today would be hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and they did quite well. But then they filed a lawsuit. They decided they were entitled to actually own the character. to make a long story short, the lawsuit alienated them from DC Comics, and they ended up parting ways. And through a lot of their adult life, Jerry and Joe lived pretty close to a pauper-like existence. Hmm. Then in the 1970s, when the big Superman movies happened, DC Comics gave them substantial annual annuities, and that worked well until they decided in the 1990s to file more lawsuits, and today it looks like they might be close to winning that lawsuit.
Now, compare, if you would, the comics and the creativity there and the nature of the stories with these movies. I remember I saw only one with Superman and Richard Pryor. Oh, they were awful. What do you think of those?
I think that most of the movies were pretty bad. The first one in 1978, which is called just Superman the Movie, it was the first Christopher Reeve movie, and the marketing slogan for the movie was, "You will believe a man can fly." And for the first time ever, Superman, on either a small screen or a big screen, really looked like he belonged up there flying. And that was a really terrific movie. And from there, they started going downhill. And some of them have been really horrible. This summer, actually, they're going to release a Superman animated movie, and next summer there's going to be another blockbuster live-action Superman, and I hope it's more on the idea of the original Christopher Reeve than on lots of the movies like the Richard Pryor one, which was miserable.
Well, speaking of miserable, when you see all these superhero movies today with the modern superheroes, they're always filled with angst, or they have emotional problems, or what have you. Is Superman ever going to be portrayed as having those human characteristics to the extent that the ones that we see in recent movies, you think?
I hope not.
And yeah,
I
agree.
One of the things that distinguishes Superman from Spider-Man, who's really fraught with anxiety, and from Batman, who's a pretty dark character, what distinguishes Superman is this sense of light. And I think that we have enough darkness and enough dark heroes in our world, and I hope Superman stays the way he was.
And Superman, though, has died a couple of times, right?
He's died repeatedly in the comic books. He died in a record-selling issue that actually sold 6 million copies in the 1990s. But what anybody who's familiar with the comics knows, you kill him off today, and you figure out a storyline to bring him back tomorrow. So he died, and he was resurrected, and it partly resurrected the whole comic book sales of Superman.
And comic books like that are no longer for kids. In fact, would you say that adults are the biggest audience these days?
They are. I would say that adults who have never quite grown up are the biggest audience, and they're, I think, the only people who can afford comic books today, which are several dollars, you know, as opposed to the 10 cents that we were starting out with. And it's partly that they've gotten more expensive, and it's partly that the storylines have gotten more adult-oriented. But it's a much smaller audience of comic books than it ever was, and a more adult-oriented one. But what gives me faith that Superman will go on forever is that every time I think that it's a little niche audience, something will happen like this TV show Smallville, and an entire generation of American kids will get re-addicted to the character and will want to see him in a movie, in an animated film. And I think his storyline is such that DC Comics and Time Warner, which own him, recognize that they'd be pretty dumb to give up on their number one franchise of a hero.
And Larry Tye, you're off to Metropolis, Superman's home, am I correct?
I am off to Metropolis. What better place to launch the book than in a town in the middle of Illinois called Metropolis, where they have an annual Superman festival that draws 30,000 people.
Wow. So this, I assume they changed the name, right, to take advantage of this, right? I mean,
Actually, Metropolis was always called Metropolis, but they changed the focus. They realized, I don't know if it was 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that with a name like that, they had to link themselves to Superman. So the biggest tourist attractions in town are the Superman Museum and all the statues. And I'm going to be in Metropolis with the woman who played in the original TV Superman series, Lois Lane, and lots of other people who played him in Smallville and other settings.
Well, that's absolutely incredible. Well, it's up and away with Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. My guest has been Larry Tye, that's T-Y-E, and you can go to LarryTye.com. There'll also be a link to the book on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Thanks for being part of Truth, Justice, and the American Way. Larry Tye.
Peter, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Divorce is never an easy decision, nor should it be. You didn't get married to get divorced, and if your thinking is right, you won't choose divorce when good alternatives exist. Having said that, if you're a man facing divorce, you should know that, like many things in life, timing is important. Too often guys find themselves in a divorce court when their businesses are thriving, when their investments are appreciating, and their income soaring. Not surprisingly, these conditions tend to produce more painful property divisions and richer support orders. The reverse is typically true when men are in less favorable financial circumstances, when their assets and their ability to pay are diminished. My point is simply this. Divorce may make the most sense for men when they can least afford it. Think about it.
Call the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor, 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
Attention business owners, this is Tony Robbins. I've spent the last 3 decades helping companies create serious business breakthroughs, and I want to help you like never before.
And this is Chet Holmes, author of the #1 business book, The Ultimate Sales Machine. If you've heard my radio spots before, maybe you don't know that about 2,000 action-oriented business owners call us every week to get our free reports. But it was Tony Robbins that challenged me to go even further for you.
Chet and I have built a serious training program called 4 Ways to Double Sales in 12 Months.
And here's what Tony convinced me to do.
We're going to give this to any business owner who calls us at 800-936-0222. Just call with your email address and we'll email you this phenomenal audio training program at our expense, not yours.
It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 4 ways to double sales in 12 months.
Call and leave us a voicemail with your email and we'll give you a program that others have paid dearly to receive. Call right now. That's 1-800-936-0222.
This is your Car Care Minute. With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely. First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure, and be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now's the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
Worldwide at WRIF.com.
Here, listen.
The Riff. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Christine, where are you calling from?
Chesterfield.
You're going to Vegas!
Oh, my God, I have never been. I cannot believe this. I'm so excited.
WRIF Sin City Takeover 2013. Learn more and sign up for your totally unfair Riff Cyber Crew Advantage now at WRIF.com.
Cowboy. Cowboy.
Well, I'm packing up my game and I'ma head out west, where real women come equipped with scripts and fake breasts. Find a nest in the hills, chill like Flint. Buy an old drop top, find a spot to pimp. And I'm a kid, rock it up and down your block, go with a bottle of scotch and watch lots of cross. Buy a yacht with a flag, stayin' chillin' the most, then rock that boots, jump and down the coast. Give a toast to the sun, drink with the stars, get thrown in the mix and tossed out of bars. Sip the Tijuana, I wanna roam, find old town, chillin' fools and come back home. Start an escort service for all the right reasons and set up shop at the top of Four Seasons. Kid rockin', I'm the real McCoy and I'm headed out west. So I'm
with a T.